Good morning. I'll call to order the meeting of this Legislative Commission on Pensions and Retirement for March 20, 2009. Let the record reflect we do have a quorum present. Today we are going to keep going until we finish our agenda, so I don't know what the end time is going to be, but you know, given the fact that this is the one of the last opportunities we've got to get the major bills to the omnibus bill, we do have to spend our time on it. Also, just for planning purposes, I'm planning on scheduling the next meeting for Monday night, March 30, at 7 p.m. in this room. Of course, I got to monitor if the House is planning any long sessions that day, because you know, if you have an afternoon session that goes late, that could affect our planning. But that's the plan right now. That's the first day, first work day after the first deadline. So I figured that we would have an opportunity to get the omnibus, take a look at the omnibus bill and get her moving so we can meet second deadline. And again, that meeting is mainly for technical corrections to the bill. There's a few things that are claimed to be emergencies. I'm taking a hard look at them. There's a lot of folks, frankly, running up to me. They say they've got real easy things that can go in the bill, and I'm not interested in easy things that can go in the bill. They can wait. But I want to focus on the things that really have to get done for right now. For this morning, we're not going to be going in the order of the items on the agenda because, for instance, Senator Pappas, well, she's moving today, but she is going to be here, but I know she wants to be here for the items that she's the chief author on. And the TRA bill is going to take quite a bit of time, so I really plan to do that later on. I have to get some of the other bills out of the way first, so don't assume that the order on the agenda is the order we're going. Since we have a quorum, I would like to adopt the minutes of March 13, 2009. Okay, yep. There we go. Sarah Pappas is here, so we might be able to go into some semblance of order. Is there a motion to adopt the minutes? Representative Nelson moves adoption of the minutes of March 13th, 2009. Discussion on that motion. Hearing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed. Motion prevails. Minutes are adopted. Okay. Let's start then with number two on the agenda, Senate File 1266. Number three. It's the second bill. Senate File 1266, Senator Pappas. House File 1527, Representative Kahn. That's the Minsky Early Separation Incentive Programs Authorization. This is Mr. Martin.
Can we stay here, or do you want us to?
Oh, just stay here. Yeah.
Mr. Chairman.
Oh, Representative Smith.
I have a question on procedure, I could ask it first.
Sure.
When we were here last Tuesday, I believe, a particular bill, House File 1279, that Representative Paymar was chief author on the Correctional State Employees Retirement. I know we heard from the commissioner, and then there were several witnesses lined up at the table to testify. A motion was offered to move the bill, which seemed to have the effect of not allowing further testimony. I'm just wondering what procedure we're using that cuts off debate in that fashion, and not debate, I mean, but testimony. What procedure are we using?
Well, Representative Smith, I felt that a motion had been made that was fairly clear what the motion was. I didn't think that hearing from, you know, further testimony from the public. I know a lot of people did travel. They wanted to be heard on that issue. It was my sense that, I sensed what they were wanted to testify on. But I think that the commission members, understood the issue well enough to make an informed vote. I didn't really hear anybody, I mean, there were some suggestions that we should bring it forward, but given the way the vote went, I think that that's the way I think the commission would have had, regardless of what the testimony was. Now, that having been said, I don't think that issue is over by any means. I think we're going to have to deal with it one way or the other, certainly in the Senate. I've talked to our leadership, and I want to get together with the committee chairs, the leads on the affected committees, and figure out just what we can or should be doing to address the SERP issue. And I've tried to tell people that, even showing up on Tuesday night, the other night, I said, this doesn't end the issue, don't by any means. This gives a sense of where people in the Pension Commission think about this particular proposal. It doesn't resolve it at all. So I think we're probably going to wind up having to do some more discussion on it, probably even in a future Pensions Commission meeting, depending upon, you know, where things go. I'd certainly be interested in if the House, you know, talks among themselves and figure out what they want to do with the Senate, and to the extent that we can handle our share, our part of that issue within this commission, we will have to do so. But as I say, I don't think that this issue is over at all. It's going to have to be resolved one way or the other. So just procedurally, I just felt that we're at a point where, you know, we could take a vote the other night and at least at that point in time know where things were at. But we're going to proceed to figure out a solution to that issue. We have to.
Mr. Chairman,
Representative Smith.
Another question on that
sure.
point. A couple reasons I'm asking about that particular incident and also the procedure is, first of all, it was Representative Paymar's bill, and he
right.
wasn't here, and I was concerned that he wouldn't have a full hearing on his bill
right.
Since some folks weren't allowed to testify. Mm-hmm. If we get into that situation again where for example, one side, if you will, has offered testimony and a motion is made to move the bill and there's additional witnesses waiting to testify. If any individual member of this commission asks to be allowed leave to engage in further questioning, will that be allowed?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
All right. Thank you.
I didn't know that there was anybody who said we need to hear from one particular person. I think Representative Kahn pointed out that, you know, we had people here to testify, and that was true. I didn't know that there was any one person that we needed to hear from. As for Representative Paymar, he actually asked not for us not to hear that bill, and I contacted him, and I said, well, because I understood that he was introducing the bill, you know, on behalf of the administration. This wasn't his proposal. It was the administration's proposal. So I said, we'd like to have a discussion on it because there's a lot of people contacting us on this. I said, if you don't feel a need to be here, you don't have to be here. And he told me that he was not intending to be here. But he actually, you know, thinking that he would have to be here, he didn't want it on the agenda. But once I made it clear that we wanted to have the discussion, he was fine with that as long as he didn't have to show up for it. So that's it's unusual, but again, I think that he was just accommodating the administration by introducing the language, not that he was advocating for it. And so he wanted just to give us the opportunity to discuss it, and I think we did.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Kahn.
Well, Mr. Chairman, you know, there were three people sitting up ready
yeah.
to testify.
Yeah.
And as I recall, of course, they didn't make statements, but their body language, if we get to interpret that as
sure.
a legislator, was that they were very happy with what was happening and they felt no need to say anything.
Okay. I didn't.
You said we weren't going to take, yeah. when you said we weren't going to take any testimony, they were all smiling and
no.
nodding.
Well, so, I originally said yeah. we weren't going to take a vote either, and we did. So,
no.
So I mean, things can change. I mean, just it's the will of the body and the will of the committee. So,
yeah.
And if I can't, I'm not very good at reading body language, though. In fact, I'm very poor at doing
well,
that.
Well, I'm not sure I am, but they were smiling and nodding, and that was pretty
okay.
definitive.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman.
But I do stress the issue is not resolved even by that vote.
Mr. Chairman, I'm sorry I missed the meeting on Tuesday, but I brought chocolate.
Now, so Senator Pappas, we had this discussion last time.
We had this discussion with Humintosh and from the Iran.
Right. Oh, we did? Not to bring food?
No,
we did.
There's protocol and within the Senate,
yeah.
but this is a joint commission.
Oh, yeah.
So, Senator Pappas, if you want to pass the food to that side of the table, that's appropriate. And if any food comes over here, I want somebody to call the sergeant at arms.
Mr.
Representative Murphy.
Mr. Chair, I just want to give a suggestion
sure.
That you might want to think of an alternative for March 30th because
okay.
you may not have a quorum.
Okay. If there's a problem with that, I need to know that. I think that's the first day, but if I know that there's a problem there, we'll shoot it to the second day, the next time, March 31st. Would is there a problem with that? Anybody else? Okay.
Well, I don't think there's as big of a problem with any other day as there might be with March 30th.
Okay, well,
I don't know that for a fact. Okay. I don't know how social people are on the pension commission.
Okay, well, I never get invited to anything, so.
Yes.
Let me know that, because if there's a problem with March 30th, we will reschedule it to the next night, March 31st. It's tentative right now. I mean, I had to get the word out, but if there's a problem, we will move to the next night, March 31st. Anything else on pension business right now? Okay, let's start with number 3 on the agenda, Senate File 1266, House File 1527. Mr. Martin.
Members, this would be item number 3 in your packets. This is a proposal that relates to the Minnesota State Colleges and University System. It allows them to create, it allows the Minsky Board to create an early separation incentive program. The program would be either cash incentives payable to the employee or employer contributions to the post-retirement health savings plan that's run by the state retirement system, or a combination of the two would permit the incentive to actually be offered either by the chancellor to the central office personnel that would be designated under the program, or to individual Minsky, by individual Minsky college or university presidents to offer to their personnel. The cost of the incentive would be borne by the entity that made the offer, so either the applicable college or university or the central office. The incentive program would be sunsetted after 5 years and does require annual reports on utilization to be turned in by the various subunits within Minsky to the Minsky board and to the legislative reference library. I believe this proposal is primarily coming out of the faculty union at the state universities, and you may want to have Mr. Stanton or someone else, if there's a Minsky representative, they may want to present the logic for this.
Sure.
And then I can lay out for you the policy issues if necessary.
Is there somebody who wants to testify on this bill? Mr. Stanton, please welcome to the commission. Please identify yourself for the record.
Mr. Chair, is this on? Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name's Russ Stanton. I am the Director of Government Relations for the Interfaculty Organization, which is the union for the faculty at the 7 state universities. They're the people, some of the people most affected by the bill. We strongly support this bill. Mr. Martin already outlined what the bill does. The two things that I would emphasize is that this is a targeted incentive, and that it's permissive legislation. It's not, it doesn't require anything. Let me just jump to why we support the legislation. As you know, we're headed into some very difficult economic times. I think even under the best case scenarios, we're probably looking at layoffs and downsizing. And it's going to extend for a while. It isn't just going to be this biennium. A common tool in the private sector for dealing with downsizing and reorganization are early retirement incentives. I know not far from me, Best Buy just offered, I think it was 3,000 employees an incentive as part of their downsizing plan. And in state government, I think it's in Mr. Martin's memo here, there's been over a dozen early separation incentives offered over the years. In higher education, the value of an early separation incentive is that if you need to downsize, you can save almost twice as much money by retiring out a person at the top end of the scale as you do by laying off somebody at the bottom end of the scale. And so there's savings that can be result from that can pay for the incentive over time. There's also in higher education, we have especially for tenured faculty, it's a fairly long layoff procedure. and with an early separation incentive, you can speed that up and result in more savings. And there's real benefits to morale. The young person is a faculty member is happy to have their job. The older faculty member is happy to have a retirement incentive. And the administration gets more flexibility in reorganizing. There have been problems with some of the separation incentives that were offered in the past, back in the 80s and early 90s. First, many of the incentives were across-the-board incentives, and when you offer an across-the-board incentive, what often happens is you lose the person that you wanted to keep, and you keep the person that maybe you wanted to have retired. They're not targeted, and so that's why in this legislation we provide that they can target the incentive not only to specific institutions or departments or programs, but right down to positions, and that way you can maximize the savings that results from an early separation incentive by targeting it exactly where you want it. Secondly, one of the problems that has been that resulted in criticism of past early separation incentives is that the incentives were paid for by an entity other than the entity that was granting the incentive. They kind of gave it away like candy because they got the benefits and somebody else paid the cost. What this does is it requires the entity that's granting the early separation incentive to pay for the early separation incentive, and that's kind of a guarantee to make sure that there's real cost savings or organizational benefits that result from the early separation incentive. In this legislation, we purposely tried to be non-prescriptive and give Minsky a lot of flexibility. And the reason for that is Minsky is a very large, complex organization. One-third of the state workforce works for Minsky. And they have employees in many, many different units, bargaining units under many different personnel plans. And what's appropriate for one type of institution might not be appropriate for another type of institution. What's good for one type of classification of employee might be different for another. And even within a system, you might have one, we have this right now, where some universities are growing quite fast, other universities are shrinking. The one-size-fits-all policy doesn't work very well. And so this tries to give a great deal of flexibility to Minsky in terms of what kind of incentives they offer and how they apply those. There is accountability built into this legislation. Minsky, unlike most agencies, has a governing board that oversees the president and the chancellor and so forth, the people that would be granting these incentives. This legislation requires that the plans be approved by the governing board and that there be reports back to the governing board on what incentives were granted what type of incentives and how much they cost, et cetera. In addition, there's a sunset provision in this legislation to force a review after 5 years. I would like to point out that this legislation was worked out with Minsky. Gary Janikowski, personnel director from Minsky, is here and can testify for it. And it's also been worked out with the other faculty unions, and the two-year faculty union also supports it if you want to hear testimony.
Well, thank you, Mr. Stanton. There is one stakeholder I am interested in knowing about. As the summary indicates on page 3, we had a virtually identical proposal during the interim study in 2003, and the Commissioner of Finance opposed early incentive programs because they just felt the state couldn't afford to deal with that. Have you had any discussion with the Commissioner of Finance or any designee from them to know if that's still their position?
I do not, particularly since this particular legislation is designed that it doesn't have an appropriation connected to it, and it's up to the institution granting it to pay for it. I guess I didn't go that route, but...
Well, again, they were pretty strong in 03 opposing those kind of ideas. So you said you had stakeholders involved, and that seemed to be one of the stakeholders, and I think I need to get that issue clarified at some point, because I don't want to have a bill running into trouble, like vetoed, you know, over something like this.
Mr. Chairman, I think we need to know, was that a Minsky-only proposal, or was it for all state employees, and, you know, what the payment structure was?
I believe it was a Minsky proposal. Representative Kahn.
Was that before Minsky moved in large part to the IRAP pension?
Was it? It's kind of in the middle.
Because it makes a huge difference as to whether it's the pension that the employer is carrying with them. Or.
Sure. Well, there were concerns, as is noted in the summary. Any questions, Mr. Stanton? Representative Smith.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Mr. Stanton, I've read where a lot of local units of government are incurring vast amounts of debt related to post-employment health care benefits. How is this proposal any different?
Mr. Stanton.
Mr. Chair, Representative Smith, this would provide for a cash settlement or a contribution to the health care savings plan. It does not promise to pay health insurance forever. I mean, it's a cash amount that goes into the health care savings plan, which is a defined contribution plan, and the employer's liability ends at the contribution to the health care savings plan.
Mr. Chairman.
It's not like a defined benefit plan where it has these long tails.
Yeah, Representative Smith.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Mr. Stanton, is it just a cash benefit that we're talking about, or is it also financed health care benefits other than cash?
Mr.
Stanton.
Mr. Chair, Representative Smith. It's a cash benefit or a contribution to the health care savings plan. And it's not paying for health insurance premiums directly. The health care savings plan is a tax-free savings plan that employees contribute their money to. A lot of, like, for instance, we contribute our severance pay to it. And that money can be used for, to pay deductibles, co-pays, premiums, whatever, after an employee retires. If they want to use the cash in that account to buy health insurance under the state health plan, they can do that. But this legislation does not provide for paying health care premiums off into the future.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Smith. Yeah.
Thank you. Mr. Stanton, is there any limit on the size of the cash payouts or cash contributions?
Mr. Stanton.
There is not. That would be left up to Minsky. That was part of the flexibility in terms of giving Minsky the authority. They're the ones responsible. They could determine the limits. And that limit might be different with different employee classifications.
Mr. Chairman. Thank you. Mr. Stanton, are these targets, are they targeted to people who would not otherwise retire? In other words, thus avoiding any windfalls in past early retirement schemes. Are these targeted to people who would not otherwise retire?
Mr. Stanton.
One would presume that that's the way they'd be designed, because that's how you get the maximum savings.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Stanton, then you want us to approve this based on a presumption.
Mr. Stanton.
Mr. Chair, Representative Smith, yes, in terms of, if you know the Minsky board, they're not a bunch of wild-eyed spenders. They're going to be very, very conservative in terms of making sure that they get the maximum return out of this. I don't know if they're, in the contracts right now, the maximum benefit a faculty member could get, and only a small portion of our faculty now are qualified. The maximum they can get is 1 year of salary and a year of health care premium, 1 year of healthcare premium. I mean, if you wanted to add that as a limitation, I think we wouldn't object to that.
Well, we have a couple of options here. I don't know if that's one of them within the packet. Did your witness wish to provide any additional information to us?
Mr. Chair, Gary Janikowski. I am with Minsky, and I would like to testify in support of this proposal. Our Vice Chancellor, Bill Chita, has sent a letter of support to Senator Pappas as well with regard to this proposal. We think it would add a lot of management flexibility during this upcoming period of downsizing.
Any questions, Mr. Janikowski? Mr. Martin, we have a couple of proposals or amendments or options in here. Could you review them?
Members, yes, there are four amendments, and they're drawn to some of the policy issues that I thought were pertinent to raise on your behalf about the bill. The first one has to do with the adequacy of the or the lack of clarity in the targeting of the incentives. The amendment doesn't propose any additional targeting, but does get to a process. There's under the piece of legislation, there's nothing to prevent the Minsky board from taking up this issue and adopting it, basically setting up the program all in one meeting without any input from all the relevant parties. So this provides for a 30-day notice period where the proposal, whatever the eligibility for the proposed program would be circulated. It would also be put up on the Minsky website, and it would have to be done with a public hearing so that the stakeholders can have an opportunity to see the process as it develops, and if there are flaws in it or there are needed adaptations, they can be made. So that's the 1A amendment.
Well, let's stop there. Senator Pappas, you chair the Higher Ed Committee in the Senate, and Senator Roebling is the lead minority member. Representative Rick Rubina chairs Higher Ed in the House. I don't recall who the lead is there, but Senator Pappas, do you think that this is something that your committee division would be interested in getting?
I think this is a good idea, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Okay. Mr. Stanton?
We're prime.
Did you wish to move the amendment, Senator Pappas?
I'll move the A1. The 1A amendment.
Okay, Senator Pappas moves the 1A amendment. Is there discussion on that motion? Hearing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, motion prevails. The 1A amendment is adopted. Mr. Martin.
Members, item 2, the amendment 2A relates to the question of whether there are any limits on the incentives as set forth in the piece of legislation. There are none, and it virtually... It would only be limited potentially by the budget of any given Minsky unit, potentially. The Amendment 2 sets a limit based on a percentage of the Minsky employee's salary, the person who's being offered the early retirement in incentive. It leaves the amount of that percentage blank for you to fill in. So it can be 1 year's salary or some multiples of 1 year's salary or some fraction of 1 year's salary.
Well, Mr. Martin, it's drawn to percent of the salary, though, so we would have to come up with a number like 50% or 75% or as opposed to?
Senator, yes. I didn't see that. I have no particular knowledge to have any idea what dollar amount would be most appropriate, and indeed there are probably a wide range of salary levels in Minsky, so a dollar amount probably would not be appropriate. Percentage would allow it to be scaled based on the circumstances of the employee while they're in employment, and seems to make sense as an incentive. So I thought percentage would probably be the most flexible way to go.
Mr. Chairman, on that point.
Yeah, Representative Smith.
Could we hear from Mr. Stanton what the range of Minsky's salaries are and where the bulk of the salaries are and in what range?
Yes, that's a good question. Mr. Stanton or Mr. Janikowski, whoever. Mr. Janikowski, would you be in a better position?
Sure.
Mr. Janikowski.
Mr. Chair, we have a variety of bargaining units and plans throughout our system. At the very highest level would, of course, be our presidents and deans and managers who are in a personnel plan. There are about 500 of those. We have mostly faculty, of course, and the salaries for the faculty, I believe, in the IFO bargaining unit go as high as about $110,000, $112,000, which would be the nine-month base salary. In the two-year colleges, I think it's substantially lower than that, something like $80,000, I believe, somewhere in that range. And then we've got, of course, the whole series of classified units, AFSCME, MAPE, and the other units that are found in other state agencies.
Well, there's some, as you know, there's some sensitivity these days in paying out bonuses and so forth, or perceived as bonuses, so we got to be quite careful as to what these incentives would be. Representative Smith.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like you to be a little more precise. You gave me four classes, the high, the presidents, et cetera, the faculty, the two-year colleges, and the classified units, but I only heard the range for the middle two, the faculty at 110 to 112, the two-year colleges at 80-plus. What is the high end of the 500, and what is the classified units range?
Mr. Stanton or Mr. Janikowski? Okay, then don't raise your hand. Mr. Janikowski.
I guess with regard to, and I don't have the salary ranges in front of me, Representative Smith, but for the administrators, that group of 500 that I talked about, it can range anywhere from in the mid-50s all the way up to some presidents can make as much as $200,000. Deans tend to make, in the state universities, deans tend to make about $130,000 are some of the salaries that I'm aware of. So they're in that salary range. In the classified units, I think you tend to find salaries for clerical and service employees somewhere more in the $30,000 range.
Thank you.
I don't have the salaries in front of me, but that's in general what we find.
Representative Kahn.
The impression I had of this, particularly with the talk of use for tenured faculty and so forth, that this was mainly conceived to be a faculty issue. I find it hard to understand why it would be of use in the administration, who could be fired at will at any moment, I think.
Well, there's obviously far more faculty, so if it's going to be used, I think that's a logical assumption.
I just don't even know what the purpose would be for an administrative early retirement.
Mr. Stanton.
I just wanted to Representative Smith's question.
Okay.
Mr. Janikowski gave the top end of our scale. I know because I sit down with just about every faculty member that's thinking about retiring in the state university. The average retiree is far, far below that. Maybe give a guess at it, but it's way below the maximum.
Well, Mr. Stanton and Mr. Janikowski, the question we have before us is that should we have a limit on the amount of an incentive that is offered to the employees? That's the amendment we have before us. Representative Thiessen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So aren't they managing this program within their own budgets? I mean, I don't know why we'd be micromanaging this part of it.
I don't know. That's the issue. So is there anybody who wants to pursue this issue? Apparently none. So, Mr. Martin, did you want to go to the next item? Number three?
Members, number three relates to the question of whether there's sufficient a review or approval of the offers of an early retirement incentive. As I read the piece of legislation, the offer can be made by a president of a Minsky institution or the chancellor without any review by anyone else, and can be implemented in a very quick order. While I think we ought to trust the Minsky institution leaders in the main, there always can be instances where something improper can occur, where the incentive is generated more by some factor, a relationship, something other than purely professional and purely economic. And so what through the 3A amendment does is requires that whoever is going to be offering the early retirement incentive has to prepare a fact sheet that is given to the Minsky board that gives the rationale for why this opposition makes sense to get an incentive, the amount of the incentive offer, the intention of the appointing authority with respect to filling the position once it becomes vacant, the expected salary savings over a 1, 5, and 10-year period, and the disclosure of any relationship beyond professional that arguably could be argued by a third party as inappropriately influencing the offer. This would provide some protection for incentives that were offered for other than purely economic and professional reasons, and may give you some idea about how you can structure that.
Representative Kahn.
I find that last phrase kind of offensive. I mean, let me say,
inappropriately
suppose,
influencing?
Yeah, inappropriate. I mean, for, let me give a situation where the relationship was that he had gone to her high school prom with her or something like that. Is that considered in that group of things, if someone would raise that? I mean, it's just so broad and so vague.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Tisa.
I imagine most of the institutions have conflict of interest policies and policies for review by their boards of trustees. I don't, again, think we need to delve into to this level of detail in this proposal.
Okay. Are we satisfied that there are enough reviews of these early incentives within the system then? If so, then let's move on to the next item.
Members, the last amendment that I have for you has to do with reemployment. There's nothing in the incentive proposal as drafted that would prohibit a person who accepts the early retirement incentive from being either reemployed or retained as a consultant. And so this sets a five-year prohibition that may or may not be the right period of time, if this makes sense to the commission. But having this be a revolving door, which potentially could occur, is not consistent with what you're trying to do with an early separation incentive, and has been an issue that the commission, when looking at past early retirement incentives, has addressed and has included a similar sort of limitation.
It would seem odd if somebody took an early retirement incentive and then showed up at work the next month, you know.
Could we I agree with you. Could we draft this in a little bit less prescriptive way, so that at least they just have to include this as part of the program that they're developing? As they develop these programs, they have to have something that addresses early separation.
But Mr. Stanton.
Mr. Chair, thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Thiessen. Minsky already has a policy 4.6, a board policy, that prohibits any reemployment of early retirees. I think it's a very legitimate question to raise, but the Minsky policy does have some flexibility in it, in that for short-term situations, a president or the chancellor may rehire an early retiree. And let me give you a good example of why that came into play. It used to be an outright ban, and then we got this flexibility. I remember the case that resulted in it. It was in Marshall, Minnesota, at Southwest State University. They needed a math professor. They lost their math professor. They had someone that had retired a couple years earlier that was totally qualified, had the PhD and so forth to teach the courses. There aren't many of those in Marshall, Minnesota. It was in the college's best, the university's best interest, and the employee was willing to do it, to rehire that person on a short period of time until they could get a position. So I just want to assure you that Minsky already has policies on this to govern it. I agree it's a totally legitimate issue. If you paid somebody to go away, you expect them to go away. I remember Senator Merriam making that argument. What's wrong? We paid these people to go away, and they're still here. I agree with the logic, but we do have a policy in place.
Representative Smith.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. On that point, Mr. Stanton, you referred to policy 4.6, that it prohibits, quote, early, unquote, retirement. Is the word early defined anywhere in the Minsky policy book?
No. And well, it in our contracts it would be defined, I believe. Mr. Martin had an amendment that would limit this incentive to people at least age 55. Because that's the normal, that's the minimum age of retirement. Oh,
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Stanton, you're not focusing on the question. I'm trying. You're saying that we don't need to put this amendment on limiting it to or restricting it for a period of 5 years because there's a policy 4.6 prohibiting early retirement. Then you went on to say it grants flexibility, and then you cited an account of someone who was separated 2 years. So I'm asking, what does early, if you prohibit early retirement already by your policy book, what does that mean in actual calendar years or months?
If they receive an early retirement incentive, that means did they get a cash incentive to leave before before age 65 is what the current rate.
Mr. Chairman, let me ask it this way. Mr. Stanton, is there anything in the policy right now that if someone were retired, is there any prohibition right now in policy that would prohibit the Minsky from rehiring them a month later for something?
Let's see. Mr. Stanton?
Not if they didn't get an incentive.
No, but I don't think it's ever, Mr. Janikowski could respond to this, but I don't think it's ever happened.
Mr. Chair, Representative Smith, what the policy requires is that the president personally approve anyone who has received an incentive, so that the hire has to be approved by the president and has to be guaranteed that it is for a very limited short period of time if they have received an incentive. If they have not received an incentive, obviously there is no prohibition on rehire.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Any other questions on this issue? Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And more of a comment. As I read this amendment, I was thinking in my brain of situations where, like you stated, that a situation could arise and you have to find a replacement and there isn't anybody on a short-term basis, death, maternity leave, something emergency comes up. So I think with the policy you have sounds to me to fit that situation and give them a little bit of flexibility. So I guess I would not support putting this amendment on.
Okay. Now, Mr. Stanton did refer to a separate amendment, and so I asked to have it distributed. I'm just looking at it now. Mr. Martin, what would this do?
Members, the 5A amendment is an amendment that Mr. Stanton requested on the behalf of the authors to have drafted. It does two things. It sets a limit on the amount of any cash incentive provided as part of the early separation incentive and limits it to 1 year of base salary. That's the page 1, line 11, line 11 amendments. And the balance sets a eligibility requirement for the incentive that the employee be at least age 55, the person to whom the incentive is being offered, and must also have 5 years of employment, at least 5 years of employment by Minsky. So it changes more to a retirement age rather than a separation at any age offer, and also avoids the circumstance of someone with very, very short service getting a potentially large incentive.
And Mr. Stanton, is this requested by Minsky then?
I talked to Minsky about it, and okay. I spoke to Mr. Martin about drafting it. I had read his early version of his memo, and he did mention that there wasn't a minimum age, and so it wasn't even clear that it was a retirement incentive. 55 is the normal minimum age to retire. Most past early retirement incentives, that's what the age is. The 5 years is that there's that $17,000 early separation incentive that's in the statute now that requires 5 years of service. So that's where I got the numbers. Mr. Martin had said that there wasn't tight enough controls here. This was an attempt to respond to that, and we would support that.
Okay. Is there a motion to adopt the 5A amendment?
So moved.
Representative Kahn moves the 5A amendment. Discussion on the 5A amendment. Hearing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. The motion prevails. The 5A amendment is adopted. Is there further discussion? Is there anybody else here who wants to be heard on Senate File 1266, House File 1527? Is there a motion to adopt the
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Kahn.
I,
moves to adopt Senate File 1266, House File 1527 as amended into the Omnibus Pension Bill. Is there a discussion on that motion? Hearing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, motion prevails. Thank you, Mr. Stamp, Mr. Janikowski. Let's see, Sarah Pappas just stepped out. Let's go to number six on the agenda, number Senate File 749, House File 950, PERA post-retirement option for general plan members. I guess this is Mr. Burke.
Members, what Senate File 749, House File 950 does is it's a new proposed program, and it would permit employees covered by parageneral other than para employees who are state employees, and the para state employees would be the staff of the para administration itself and certain miscellaneous groups of state employees who have para coverage, one of them being some court employees who several years back became state employees rather than local or county employees, and they were given an option to retain the para coverage if they wanted to. Some of them did, so we have some of those individuals and a few other groups who are technically state employees but who are members of para. So the proposed para program would not include those individuals because those individuals are included in the existing state program. But for the proposed para pro meaning post-retirement option program, the individual will have to be at least age 62. It'd have to be immediately eligible to draw a para retirement annuity, and they would have to terminate, and they could be immediately rehired in a position which is at least a 25% reduction from the prior employment and no more than half time. It's totally up to the employing unit to decide whether to participate in this program and whether to offer positions under the program. What the program does offer these employees is that the reemployed annuitant maximum exempt earnings limitations would not apply. The program would be temporary. There's an expiration date of June 30th, 2011, whereas the state program is permanent. Mr. Chairman, do you want me to start going through the policy?
No, let's hear from Ms. Vanek first, and then we'll go back to you on the issues. Ms. Vanek.
Mr. Chair and members, Mary Vanek, PERA Director. The board reviewed the different proposals that you've seen before, the state's phased retirement program and other rehiree provisions, and they split their decision-making process into two segments. They wanted to address this phased retirement program this year in response to the cities and counties' concerns about having a similar opportunity as the state for its people to phase into retirement. Some of the rehiring retirees and their earnings limit, you will see a separate bill totally from us in the next year or two. This bill is drawn more narrowly than the state's program because the board wants to kind of test this out and see if it has any adverse impact. Our actuary reviewed our retirement experience and has indicated that the impact on our actuarial condition is so insignificant it doesn't even show up. But the board wanted to be sure of that, and that's why they drew this very narrowly, and they drew it with an expiration date. We are limiting it to what the IRS does allow. It was passed in the Pension Protection Act of 2006, which allows a distribution to a plan participant while they are still working if they are at least age 62. So we stuck to that. The state's program allows it for those under 62 if they're eligible for Rule of 90 and take a 30-day break. But we did not want to go down that path right away because we don't have any policing authority to verify that people don't have plans to return and have prearranged, and that's a little bit difficult for us given our size. So what this provision does, and I do have an amendment that I provided to Mr. Birick, and I apologize, we miscommunicated, but what the bill does is that it allows local units of government to offer to individuals over age 62 an opportunity to reduce their working hours by half or a 25% reduction if they're already part-time, collect their pension without a break in service, and continue in this type of program for up to 5 years at the discretion of the employer.
Okay. And did you have another witness, or did somebody else wish to answer?
The League of Minnesota Cities is here to speak on behalf, to address their support.
Let's hear from you now. Welcome to the Pension Commission. Please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you. My name is Laura Kushner. I am with the League of Minnesota Cities. I work in the Human Resources Department there, and my primary function is giving advice to cities on human resources and pension issues. The League originally worked with PERA on this bill for the past couple of years, and we saw it then as a workforce planning tool, and it is still that. It will still help us maintain institutional knowledge in our cities by allowing employees to phase into retirement. But frankly, times have changed since we started working on this bill, and we now see it as a helpful budget savings tool as well. Basically, it would allow the city to offer a phased retirement approach to any employee age 62 or older, as Mary Vanek said, who is eligible to retire. So, for example, a full-time employee could cut their hours in half. The city would save all of those wages. They would also save the para contribution. So it's a very small pool of people that it would apply to, but in some cities and in some situations, it could be a very helpful budget savings tool. And basically a win-win for both the city and for the employee/retiree. Now, the other thing I wanted to point out is that the bill limits participation to only 5 years, and it's the city's option to renew that every year. So this is not going to be something that drags on. It's not a way for people to collect tons of money and just keep working and being retired. It's a limited, very limited in scope bill. And the last thing I just want to say is that the League enthusiastically supports this bill, and we ask for your vote in moving it forward today, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Are there any questions? Okay, Ms. Burke, what policy issues do we have to look at here?
Well, the first one is whether there's sufficient need for this program. And the testifiers have indicated that they sort of want this to be small. But if it is small, it may not have any meaningful impact. So it's not clear that it actually meets any real needs here. Number two is that whether there's sufficient incentive to participate. The only difference from being in this program or out of this program is that if the individuals are part of this program, they would not be subject to the reemployed annuity earnings limits. Now, under the para reemployed annuitant earnings limit, it's tied to the limits in Social Security that's used by the Social Security Administration for Social Security benefits. And currently, an individual could earn $14,000, $14,160 to be exact, in the current year without bumping into the limit. In other words, it would have no impact whatsoever. So for individuals who are fairly low paid right now, earning $28,000 or less, and if they enter this program, or if they were to enter this program, the most they could earn would be about $14,000 since they could work only part-time. But the program would do nothing for them. So really this program isn't aimed at the lower paid individuals, but individuals who are moderately to higher paid. But even for those individuals, it's not clear that what the program offers them is really worth anything to them. It's a matter of personal preference. For income that's earned above that exempt limit, and that would be the $14,000, what PARA would do is reduce the annuity by $1 for every $2 in excess of the limit. And it would shift that money into an account, a savings account for the individual, payable with 6% interest. So if somebody wants to go back to work but wants part of it deferred, maybe this program is of interest. But if individuals have technically retired and they don't need the current income, they want to have part of it deferred, it's not clear why they retired. Another issue is the justification of the difference between PERA's proposed program and the state proposed program. Ms. Vanek indicated that there are differences in the eligibility requirements, and those are summarized on page 3 of the memo for you. And one of the differences that I'd like to mention is that with the proposed PERA program, the individual has to be at least 62 to be included in this program, whereas in the state program, an individual can be under 62, provided they qualify for a rule of 90 benefit. Now, this raises some issues for consistent treatment of individuals covered by PERA General, because PERA staff and state employees covered by PERA would be in the state program, which has slightly different eligibility requirements, than the individuals who would be covered by the PERA program. In particular, for instance, a staff member for PERA could be under 62, and right now they're covered by the state program, and they could qualify for that program if they qualify for a rule of 90 benefit. But that same individual would not qualify for this proposed PERA program. So there may be some issues where individuals, local and county employees perhaps, may contend that PERA staff should not be treated differently than the bulk of the other PERA employees. Another issue I raise is that this is another case where it's an attempt to take advantage of in-service distributions, which are permitted by the federal government, provided the individual is at least age 62. The state did not permit in-service distributions, in other words, distributions of retirement assets to individuals who are still employed, who really have not had a true termination of employment, until, I believe it was 2 years ago, when in an admin bill there was a provision for TRA, which permitted teachers who were at least age 62 to terminate, come immediately back to work if they could be rehired, draw the annuity, and essentially continue working, possibly in the exact same position for exact same hours as before. But that passed without much discussion. We also have in-service distributions in the state PRO program. And this program would also have in-service distributions. And the issue I raise here is whether the commission and the legislature wants to go further down that path without seriously looking at that policy. One of the implications, and Ms. Vanek touched on this, is that this can have implications for the funding of the pension plans. When individuals are in these kinds of programs, they are taking on the role of an active employee, but they are no longer an active member of the plan. They're no longer making contributions to the plan. And so to the extent that you have individuals in these categories displacing individuals who would otherwise be active members of the plan, the membership base is shrinking. But you've got a plan that has unfunded liabilities. These unfunded liabilities have to be amortized. But they're going to be amortized over a smaller membership base. And to the extent that employees will be responsible for paying off some of that amortization requirement, it places an additional burden on the active employees who are, in fact, contributing to the plan. Now, as Ms. Vanek indicated, the effect is likely to be minimal, because, frankly, the use of this program is likely to be minimal. But to the, if this leads to further use of this type of arrangement, it can have some implications for the funding of these plans, which the commission may wish to consider. One issue, which actually is sort of a byproduct of something I mentioned a minute or two ago, and that is the commission may want to consider what plan para staff and para state employees should be in if para pro is in fact enacted. Should they be in the same program with the same eligibility requirements as the bulk of para covered employees, in other words, the local and county employees, or should they be subject to remain in the state pro program and be subject to the slightly different eligibility requirements? If the commission is interested in pursuing that, I've got some amendments prepared and they're discussed here to shift para staff to the para pro program and also possibly shift the other para state employees to the para pro. Regarding the total duration issue, right now the drafting specifies that individuals can't be in this program more than 5 years. That seems to be language that was borrowed from the state program. Now, in the state program, it makes more sense because individuals could be fairly young in that program, could be in it for a considerable number of years, because an individual with a rule of 90 benefit could qualify for state pro. But with the proposed para program, you have to be 62. And again, the only advantage, if it is an advantage, of being in this program is that you're exempt from this reemployed earnings limitation. Well, once an individual hits the age for full receipt of Social Security benefits, any reemployed earnings limitation no longer implies. So individuals would hit that at 65 or 66. So since the youngest you can enter is 62, they would no longer be subject to those limitations after 3 years, perhaps 4 years, and not 5 years. So the commission may wish to shorten that period. And what I did is I prepared an amendment that's described here to indicate that a position, pro position, could not be renewed once individuals hit that Social Security earnings limitation. A reason for considering that amendment is that an individual who was not particularly informed, didn't fully recognize the implications, could be hurt by remaining in the program. Because if they remain in the program, they can't work more than half time, because that's a requirement of the program. Whereas if they weren't in the program, they could work full-time, and they'd still not be subject to these limitations. So they could actually be harmed by remaining in the program. Another issue is there is no statement of insurance coverage. In the state pro program, there is a paragraph indicating that for individuals who are in the state pro program, the employer has to continue to make a contribution towards for insurance for the individuals, and there's some formulas there prorating it because it's part-time, but basically the maximum that an employer could make is a 75% of the contribution that would be made for a full-time active employee. And with this proposed program, there is no statement at all. The implications of that is somewhat unclear. Perhaps it means that the employer can't offer insurance, or perhaps it means that it would be up to each individual employing unit to decide whether or not to offer insurance and just how much that insurance would be. So the commission may want to consider adding a provision, and I've got an amendment to do that, which I borrowed from the state program. That would create some uniformity if the commission feels that perhaps there shouldn't be that much discretion given to local units of government. And the final issue is temporary versus permanent. The state program is permanent. This one is temporary. The commission may wish to use some other date other than 2011 as an expiration, or perhaps it may wish to make it a permanent program.
Ms. Vanek or Ms. Kirshner, any response?
Yes, thank you.
Why don't you move the microphone a little closer to you? Yeah.
Is that better?
Yeah.
Okay. The one thing that I would like to respond to on behalf of city, well, two things, actually. With regard to the insurance issue, given that the league represents 854 cities, it's hard for us to know exactly what insurance issues are in each city. And therefore, we'd like to leave that up to the individual city to work out with the employee. There may be situations where the employee is covered by their spouse and doesn't need the insurance. That would save the city some money. And in reality, to make this program advantageous for the employee, the cities realistically probably will have to offer health insurance. But in some cities, they may not. And we'd like to leave that up to the city to decide, because in these budget times, every dollar that they can save is helpful. The second thing I would like to address is maybe it would help the commission to picture an exact situation that might occur out there. One of the things that I talk to cities routinely about is in greater Minnesota, they may not have license holders that they need. So, for example, if a city needs a Class A water license superintendent, somebody, maintenance supervisor that has that license, and they cannot, and this is happening right now, I get these calls all the time, they can't find anybody with that particular kind of license. And what happens is the person that has it is getting ready to retire, but the city's in big trouble. They don't have anybody to go to that has that license. And yes, they can train somebody, and those licenses aren't that hard or that long to get, but it takes a little time. So this would be the kind of situation where you could phase somebody for a year, talk them into hiring, to staying on part-time, use their license to cover the city while they train somebody else in that job. So I think for some cities throughout the state, this will be a very helpful tool, both on workforce planning and budget savings level.
Ms. Vanek?
Mr. Chair and members, to address some of Mr. Barrick's concerns, first of all, the PERA staff and the other state employees who are in PERA should stay in the state's program. The state's program does afford them insurance coverage to some degree that is authorized in the state statute. And without that authorization, we would have to be dealing individually with collective bargaining and the various personnel agreements related to our staff and the other state employees who are covered. And so because we are state employees, we just happen to be in the PERA pension plan, I think it's more appropriate that PERA staff and all other state employees who are members of PERA remain as part of Chapter 43A. With respect to the in-service distribution issue that Mr. Barrick raises, which means essentially that everybody would have to have a 30-day break before they could enter this program, we have heard repeatedly that that creates a problem, and that if they want to retain people, even if it's just for a year or two, because federal law does allow them to continue without the 30-day break, we'd like the opportunity to use that authorization as a qualified plan. With respect to Mr. Barrick's mention of the Social Security issue, I don't disagree with him. Under the limited scope of the bill, individuals will hit Social Security normal age before they this program expires. But if we lift the sunset date, which I really truly believe we will be back in 2 years to report on the use of the program and ask for you to lift the sunset date, then the 5 years does fit a little better. If we decide in the future to expand the program below age 62 to mirror more so the state's program, the five-year does fit appropriately. So we structured the bill in anticipation of that.
Okay, any questions, Mr. Barrick or the witnesses? Mr. Barrick, you have a technical amendment, and could you review what that does, the 1A amendment?
Members, that's the 1A amendment, and what it does is it adds a few words to the bill to make it quite clear that this applies only to PERA general members and not to members of PERA police and fire. And it also adds some language to the expiration date to indicate just what has to occur when that expiration date is hit. It indicates that no para position can be renewed after that date, and presumably no new position would be named to it. But it allows anyone currently in a para pro position on that expiration date to continue at least until the end of the year, at least until the end of the existing agreement.
Ms. Vanek, have you had a chance to review the amendment?
Mr. Chair, members, I don't support line 1.6 of the amendment because as I read it, it says that if somebody's already in the program, after the sunset date, they can't renew to continue throughout for that five-year period. We do agree with Mr. Barrick. If we're going to keep the sunset date, we don't want people to be allowed to be able to enter the program after the sunset date. But if they are already in the program, it was our intent to allow them to fulfill the full five-year period. So it's only line 1.6, if I'm reading it correctly, that we wouldn't support in this amendment.
But apparently, clarifying this PERA general, that's appropriate, you think? And then saying that the individuals must not be appointed to a post-retirement option position after that date. That's okay. So you would say support the amendment up through 1.5 to the word date,
yes,
and not everything after that. Okay. Okay, what's the pleasure of the commission? Does anybody wish to discuss the 1A amendment or do anything with it? So,
well, Mr. Chairman, I'll move the 1A amendment as amended.
Okay, so Sarah Pappas moves the 1A amendment. To incorporate on page 1.5, after the word date, put a period, strike the word and then strike the line of 1.6. Is there discussion on that motion? Hearing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, motion prevails, the 1A amendment is adopted. Mr. Bierk, you sort of grouped other amendments together, and you've kind of discussed them overall. So is there any other comments you need to make on eligibility requirements beyond the comments that you've made?
No, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Ms. Vanek, do you have any thoughts on the eligibility amendments, 2A, 3A, 4A, 5A, or 6A? Or?
Mr. Chair, we wouldn't support any of those amendments.
Okay. Any discussion with the commission members on any of those amendments or desire any additional information? Okay. The expiration date. I think you've already discussed that, Mr. Burek, in your comments. Any further comments you wish to make?
No.
Okay, Ms. Vanek?
Mr. Chair, we wouldn't support those amendments.
Okay. Either. Any discussion with the commission members? Now, number 9A, Ms. Vanek, I thought you said you did not disagree with the Social Security one. Is that what I...
Mr. Chair, in principle, I understand Mr. Burek's position, and we could certainly go back to 5 years if we lift the sunset date. It was really drawn with the anticipation that we would lift that sunset date in the future. So it's either way. I'm kind of neutral on whether you adopt it or not.
And, Mr. Burek, could you clarify again what the 9A amendment does?
What the 9A amendment would do is it would prohibit extending a pro position beyond the age at which the individual reaches Social Security normal retirement age. And frankly, I don't see why it's an issue whether or not this program is extended, whether that makes sense. I drafted the amendment as a way to make sure individuals aren't harmed by remaining in this program after the point where the program simply no longer makes sense to them. The only thing that the program would do at that point is it would limit them to a maximum of half-time employment without giving them any advantage in terms of exempt income.
Mr. Chair, we can accept the 9A amendment.
Okay. Discussion of commission members? Anybody?
I'll move it.
So Representative Thiessen moves the 9A amendment. Is there discussion on the 9A amendment? Hearing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed. Motion prevails. The 9A amendment is adopted. And the 10A amendment is insurance contributions. Mr. Burek, any further comments on that? We've covered that already. Ms. Vanek, you indicated that you didn't think it was needed. Is that?
Mr. Chair, Ms. Kushner referenced that the cities have their own different structures, so it's not needed.
Is there discussion from commission members? Appears to be none. Is there anybody else who is here who wants to be heard on Senate File 749, House File 950? Is there a motion to adopt? There's discussion. Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To Ms. Fanick or the witness, could you just explain a little more clearly where this is, the need is for this? What types of cities? Are we talking the large, small, and areas of the state? Can you clarify a little bit more who is asking for this?
Ms. Kirshen.
Thank you. Yes, I've already gotten calls from large and small communities interested in this. We've publicized that this bill was going to be heard, and again, it's going to be a unique situation where you have somebody that's age 62, eligible to retire, pretty much getting ready to retire, but not completely ready, you know, or the city has a specific need, like a city engineer. Engineers are very difficult to recruit right now, and let's say your city engineer is 63 or 64. Wants to go out, but kind of likes the idea of phasing out, working half-time. The city desperately needs to keep that person while they find someone else with an engineering, the appropriate engineering degree, and makes other arrangements. So it's a phase-out. It's good for the city, allows them to keep that knowledge, good for the employee. They can keep working part-time, start getting used to the idea of retirement. It's very much a win-win. For a smaller city, it may be more of a budget savings tool where they have five employees and they need to cut a position, and instead of laying somebody off, they can make one of them a half-time position. So actually, it could be budget savings tool in a larger city as well. So either of those. Is that helpful?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I would like to make the comment that we were just the previous bill we were working on early retirement, and now we're looking at extending the situation.
There's a document being passed out. Apparently, it's been requested, I think, by Ms. Vanek. I'm just looking at it for the first time. Ms. Vanek, is there something that you wanted us to also consider here?
Mr. Chair and members, when I drafted the bill, I overlooked a couple of issues that really should be taken care of to make it technically correct. And I shared this with Mr. Burek, but we kind of crossed paths on this issue. What it does is it clarifies that an individual is not terminating public employment. They're terminating membership in PERA to be able to participate in this program. So we've added reference to that in our termination of membership section of statute to say that under this phased retirement program, they terminate membership. And then we went into the bill and took out reference to terminated public employment and put in the reference to terminating membership, because they're not quitting their job. They're staying employed, reducing their hours, and terminating their membership in PERA as an active participant.
Ms. Burke, have you had a chance to look at this? Does it work?
Mr. Chairman, if you give staff a little latitude, we can make it work. It's good enough.
Okay. All right. Is there discussion on, I guess, the document that Ms. Vanek prepared? Mr. Representative Thiessen, do you want to move?
I'll move. Sure.
Mr. Burek.
Could I ask Ms. Vanek?
Oh, yeah, go ahead. Yeah.
Ms. Vanek, under this amendment, individuals would have to terminate membership but not actually terminate employment. Is this distinction you have in your fund? You have a termination of membership provision and you have a termination provision. Is that distinction consistent with federal plan qualification requirements?
Ms. Vanek?
Have you examined that?
Mr. Chair and members, the federal law does not specifically reference that you have to have this termination of membership, because we already define the difference between termination of public employment and service to a public employer and termination of membership or participation in the plan, we thought it was necessary in our own state statute. But there's no reference to it in federal law.
So individuals can terminate membership but continue providing public employment. I mean, basically no difference from one day to the next other than they've technically terminated membership.
Ms. Vanek.
I must confess the concept that has troubled me over time, and now that you're bringing it into this program as well, I just want to make sure that this isn't going to get you into some sort of trouble.
Well, there's a couple of situations that I can remember right off the top of my head, and that is, number one, there are sometimes individuals who are reported to PERA who should not be in the plan. And there's a statute of limitations, I believe, going back to January of 1990, I think is the date, that if we catch them, they have to terminate membership. They can continue to work in public sector. They just can't be members in the plan because they don't meet the eligibility, or they're in a position that's specifically excluded. And also, there's a provision in our law that says city managers have an option. And within the first 6 months that they're employed as a city manager or city administrator, they are reported to PERA, but within that 6 months, they can opt out of membership in PERA, even though they continue to be a public service, in public service. And that's the reference to 353.028 in the second clause of that existing language. So that's why we have a distinction between termination of actual public employment and public service to a governmental subdivision, and one of membership in PERA. And this, we believe, aligns with that whole type of policy.
Okay, any questions? Then Representative Thiessen then moves that the document submitted by Ms. Vanek be adopted with authorization to the staff to make whatever changes they need to make it fit, I guess. Discussion on that motion. Hearing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Is there anybody else who's here who wants to be heard on Senate File 749 or House File 950 as amended? Is there a motion there? Senator Pappas moves then that Senate File 749, House File 950 as amended be incorporated in the omnibus omnibus pensions bill. Discussion on that motion. Hearing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed. Motion prevails. Okay, thank you,
thank
Ms. Vanek.
Thank you.
Senator Pappas will do the Senate File 686, the cost of living adjustment, and this is the St. Paul teachers issue. And I believe that we had a discussion on this on March 6th, and your request, we laid it over. So what do we have?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I do have a handout that's a relative cost scenario that Mr. Kapler asked me if I would hand out to the members. So I'll pass this. Thank you. We can hear from Mr. Kapler.
Yeah. Mr. Kapler, welcome back. do we have any amendments to pass out or anything here?
Mr. Chairman, yes, we do.
Why don't we pass out whatever we've got so that we have whatever we need before us? Mr. Kapler.
Mr. Chairman, members, thanks for having us back, and thanks for taking up the bill again. What was passed out by Senator Pappas is a worksheet with a whole bunch of numbers on here, and the purpose in putting this together was to address a concern that was aired at the last meeting, and I think it was Senator Olson who had the greatest concern about this. But intuitively to some folks, it doesn't make sense that in comparing the COLA that is in place for the statewide plans, which is a flat 2.5% increase each year, and a COLA that moves up and down between 0 and 5%, but matching the Social Security increases, which are pegged to CPI, where the average is 2.7%. I think that some members had some questions about what seems to us an intuitively self-evident thing, but it isn't necessarily a fact that the 2.5% flat rate COLA could end up being a more expensive proposition than a COLA that moves and changes but averages 2.7 over the same period. And that's the whole point of this worksheet. What it does is just show the cost of living adjustment for St. Paul teachers in a scenario, and you could run any number of these scenarios, and this isn't the only one that could apply, and there are certainly scenarios where the 2.7% average COLA could be higher, any number of them, but probably the more appropriate way to do this would be with something like a Monte Carlo type scenario generating model, except that wouldn't be the valid model either because it would assume random sort of selection of possible values. And that doesn't work because CPI is a serially correlated statistic. So what happens here is inflation is moved up 0.5% each year between 0 and 5 because those are relevant or applicable values for the COLA as proposed in the bill. And it's held flat at 2.5%, which is the state model. And what is calculated in the far right column is sort of the cumulative annual savings, which total up at the end of the period, this particular 25-year period, at $27 million in reduced costs relative to a flat 2.5%. We're not saying that that's absolutely what's going to happen. What we're saying is it is not the case that a 2.7% average COLA, which is based on 100 years of CPI history, is more expensive proposition than a flat 2.5% COLA. And that's what the purpose of this worksheet was to address that one particular concern that arose in the last discussion.
Mr. Chairman?
Sir Pappas.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Kapler, would you articulate why your proposal of a COLA that changes is a better idea than the flat 2.5?
Well,
Mr. Kapler.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Pappas, the rationale for bringing the COLA forward and asking Senator Pappas to carry the bill, both in 2007 and again this year, was the purpose of a cost of living adjustment for retirees is to maintain the purchasing power of their benefit within cost limitations and financing limitations that we have to acknowledge, and the absolute 5% cap that the legislature clearly has a policy on. So that was the whole design. It's to make sure that when a person earns a benefit, and a benefit that we have targeted paired with Social Security to keep them at the same standard of living approximately that they were at immediately before retirement, that that purchasing power and that benefit doesn't deteriorate in value immediately or over the long term as a retiree. And the only way that you can give any real good assurance of that is to match cost of living adjustments and do that within some constraints. That's what this does. It matches Social Security. And the other compelling piece of the rationale for our board is 40% of our members' benefits, the coordinated plan members going forward, which is going to be virtually all of our retirees, are going to be paired with Social Security. And the way Social Security calculates COLAs now, it's CPI-based. And the way this formula works, we would be matching them up to 5%, no higher than that. And it made compelling sense for our board that those two pieces, the 60 and the 40% of the benefit that their members are going to be getting, should be pegged to the same cost of living adjustment. Otherwise, you're creating disparities in the benefits that are paid out between those two streams of income. So that was the other piece of the rationale. This is a proposal that's consistent with Pension Commission principles. It makes the COLA identical to what Social Security is going to be paying out in most years, which I think is much more understandable to the members and the retirees. And it removes the confounding effects that investment markets over the short term can have on these plans. And we know that giving away excess investment earnings against any base has been an extremely expensive proposition for public plans in Minnesota. It has been a major leak in the funding structure and one that is never captured in the actuarial valuations as they are now done until we're post-fact. And we pick up those cost impacts after they've been implemented. So that was the rationale. I think the board's position at this point is that the proposal makes sense. They think that the technical amendment that was offered by Mr. Burek at the last meeting makes good sense and cleans it up and puts the bill in better form. But as far as extending the sunset, which was another proposal that was considered, or modifying the investment-related triggers, we're not in favor of those because the whole idea was to associate the COLA with Social Security and disassociate the COLA with volatile and ephemeral investment market activity and experience.
Representative Thiessen.
No, I don't have anything right now. So Where is this sitting
right now? Well, that's my question, too. I mean, we had a couple of amendments distributed, so I'm not quite sure what proposal.
So is the question, well, it sounds like they don't want the sunset extended. I thought the question was, should we extend it for 2 years or for 1 year?
Yeah, I don't know. We had some amendments distributed. I don't know what the proposal is at all. Mr. Burek,
Mr. Chair, can I ask a few questions?
Sure, go ahead.
This handout?
Yeah.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Kapler, that first column, St. Paul Teacher Retirement Fund, COLA. Now, this column gives you an arithmetic average of 2.7?
Of 2.7, yes.
An arithmetic average. What you really need is a comparison of a geometric average of a 2.7 with a 2.5. I think you've understated it here. Well, another problem with this is that you know, you started with 0, 1, 1.52, and gone up, and then start that sequence all over again. So in the first year, you have no COLA under this handout in 2010, whereas the state does. So basically, it's a comparison of a flat state COLA paying 2.5% every year from 2010 through 2035, but the para COLA is actually doesn't start until 2011. It starts a year later, which is going to understate the cost of this one. And again, I suspect that what you actually have here is a series of increases that would actually be less than 2.7, less than the equivalent of a 2.7% inflation rate, because it's an arithmetic rather than a geometric average.
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Kapler.
And Mr. Burek, the cost of living adjustment average statistic that we're basing this off of in pulling a number out to base an average on for building the normal cost of the plan is an arithmetic statistic drawn from the CPI statistics compiled by the Bureau of Labor Statistics, and it's a number that's recomputed every year. While it's serially correlated with inflation experience in the prior year, that is to say this year's number is a function of prior year CPI, it is a standalone calculation each year, and it gets applied to the base level benefit each year, and there's a new incremental cost each year, so a geometric average doesn't make any sense to me. And our proposal does start in 2010, so I rolled the state increase back to a flat 2.5. It could be higher. And, you know, where you start, right now we're in a quandary right now because we've got experts out there who can't agree whether inflation is going to be 1, 2% next year or negative. I mean, we really are at a point where the Federal Reserve is seriously worried about a deflationary environment. Under a more draconian scenario, like I say, this thing could be run out any number of ways. This isn't meant to be dispositive. We could have 2 or 3 years of flat or negative inflation. And under that scenario, the numbers or the savings between these two proposals would go up dramatically because you'd be front-loading a 2.5% increase. With the flat increases against basically a flat COLA on our side. And that would make sense. It would keep the retirees even with inflation. That's the whole purpose. But the purpose of this isn't to demonstrate that everywhere and always this cost of living formula would result in lower costs. It's not designed to save money per se. The primary purpose of this thing is to keep the purchasing power of the retirees even with inflation. This was just one scenario to demonstrate that it is not absolutely or necessarily the case that a COLA that averages 2.7% is going to cost more than a COLA that's a flat 2.5. That's the sole point of this exercise. It isn't to say that it is always and in every case going to result in lower costs. We don't say that.
Yeah. Tell you what, we're running into this time of session. Senator Pappas is needed in another committee right now, and she's going to have to be there for a while. This is her bill, her issue. So I'm going to have to lay it over until she gets back. Okay. Well, we'll circle back to it. Senator Olson is not here yet. I'm not sure she had.
She told me. She told you.
She told me to take.
Oh, okay. So why don't we move on to number four then and do Senate File 1267, House File 1528, Representative Kahn, and then yeah, Senator Olson told me she may not be able to be here today. So let's go to that one.
Yes, okay. I think this is another one that we would like to have Mr. Stanton explain.
Mr. Stanton?
Explain for us.
Peggy?
Yeah, we need somebody. Yeah.
Thank you.
We did not adopt anything.
Gotcha.
Mr. Chair, members, again, for the record, Russ Stanton, Interfaculty Organization, we support this bill, as a matter of fact.
What does it do?
Pardon me?
Okay. What does it do?
Okay. House File 1528, Senate File 1267 would allow faculty members who are in the Individual Retirement Account Plan, or IRAP, to voluntarily switch to the Teacher's Retirement Account Plan within 1 year after reaching tenure or its equivalent. If a faculty member switched to TRA, they would have to buy back all of the years of service in IRAP, and that's important because TRA wanted it that way, and to pay the full actuarial cost of the buyback. It would be borne by the person making the switch. Currently, faculty members who begin at Minsky are placed in the IRAP plan as their basic pension plan. They have an option currently within the first year to switch to TRA. Only about 15% of the two-year faculty and only about 10% of the state university faculty exercise that option to switch to TRA. The vast majority do stay in IRAP. The main reason they stay in IRAP, it's a defined contribution plan. It's like an IRA. That's where the name came from. And if faculty members change jobs, they take their retirement savings with them because it has no and it doesn't have any adverse impact on their retirement savings. In higher education, unlike K-12 education, we have a very large number of short-term faculty members, what I'd call casual employees. Adjuncts, fixed-term faculty, community faculty, customized trainers, people like that. We also have all new faculty who are hired as probationary faculty. And in the case of the state universities, they don't get tenure typically until their fifth year of service. So having the portability option in IRAP offers something very attractive to new faculty. Some faculty, and again from experience, it's a fairly small percentage, would like the option of switching to TRA when they reach tenure.
Please stop, hold it.
The reason is that once they're tenured, their employment tends to be much more secure, and so portability is far less important to them. And some of these faculty are risk adverse, and under TRA, they don't have to make investment decisions. The state takes all the investment risk under TRA. This bill would not cost Minsky anything. The buybacks are paid for entirely by the faculty member doing the buyback. You might recall that this bill was introduced last year, and TRA at that time raised some concerns about its effect on TRA funding, and there was an amendment put in the bill that had an actuary do a study. The actuary concluded that if all faculty members switched to TRA and bought back past service at full actuarial cost, it would have a slightly beneficial impact to TRA's funding. But, of course, not all faculty members would switch, and there is some risk of adverse selection. particularly if the faculty members that switched were over 50 and had long service. And to limit that possibility of adverse selection to TRA, we incorporated several safeguards. First of all, we limit the switch to people to when they get tenure, which in our case is 5 years. The community or technical college is typically 3 years. And that means that the vast majority of people that switch would be under 50 and would have very short service. Also, when only people with 5 or less years of service switch, the chance that they will benefit TRA financially is almost twice as great as the chance that they would harm or cost TRA financially. I passed out from the actuary's report a table, and you can see employees with 5 or less years of service, if they were to switch in about 1,200, if they were to all switch, in about 1,200 cases, TRA would gain. In about 606 cases, TRA would lose. So the probability of TRA gaining is quite large. Secondly, we did put a 5-year sunset in the bill so that there can be some evaluation. If we did start seeing that there was adverse selection against TRA, we can do something about it. I want to point out most of our older members are in TRA. Younger members are in IRAP. We don't have any, I mean, we're very concerned about TRA's funding and protecting TRA's funding and not adversely selecting, having adverse selection to it. Third, what this bill does is it requires the full actuarial cost at the switch. Long-term employees, my experience is when they look at doing a buyback, if they're long-term, the price tag usually shocks them and they're not interested. In summary, this would be, bill would give faculty an attractive new option. It would not cost the employer anything, and it would TRA's funding. On this issue, they're supportive of the legislation so long as it does not, as long as it's limited to the at tenure. If you threw it wide open, they would oppose it. This is limited just to when tenure. And they support the legislation also. So we do encourage your support.
Mr. Janikowski, do you have anything to add?
Pardon me?
Do you have anything to add?
Other than Mr. Chair supporting this, no, I do not.
Okay. Mr. Martin, did you want to review some issues that we have before us here? Cool.
Members, I think the chief issue with this bill is the adverse selection. I think Mr. Stanton has talked about this. The study that was done in response to the 2008 piece of legislation assumed everybody chose to change and looked at what the consequence would be. There is, in if you look on page 14 of the staff memo, I have a little more of that actuarial work that was done in response to the 2008 law. And if you look at the key points portion of the report, you will note periodically there's references to ignoring adverse selection. Various things occur. And the real key here is who will choose to exercise this. There are folks who will be benefited by it if they can make the service credit purchase. Those are the folks who are likely to do it. It will not be a total group effort. So other than warning you that you do have adverse selection potential here, which you can't gauge fully, this doesn't have any real significant issues. There's one amendment that I propose. It's a substantive amendment. Currently, the default is everyone goes into IRAP unless they choose to affirmatively go into TRA, and this is trying to address that problem of people who later on decide they want a second bite at the apple. It's easier to take people out of a defined benefit plan than it is to bypass service credit in a defined benefit plan. So if the current default is IRAP, and then you have to do certain things to plug the hole, we could do this thing differently. We could put the default to be TRA, and we could just simply refund out members' contributions. It's easier to put them in the same shape they would have been in a defined contribution plan than a defined benefit plan. But that would be a significant change in the structure of IRAP.
Mr. Stanton, did you have a chance to review that amendment then?
Yes. We would be opposed to making TRA the default. That's been an issue in the past, and the commission has decided, had moved the other direction, that they, for instance, the technical colleges once had TRA as the default, and they moved to making IRAP the default. The reason why we'd oppose having TRA being the default is, first of all, when people vote with their feet, you know, in state university faculty, 90% of them choose IRAP. It would make sense to have the default be what most people want. Secondly, when you make TRA the default, we have an enormous number of, as I said, part-time casual employees, and Mr. Janikowski just handed me a thing, about 2,263 part-time temporary part-time
total new
people, and if TRA was the default and they were to switch to IRAP, they would lose the employer contribution that had been made to TRA on their behalf, and TRA would be that would obviously make TRA happy that they get the turn back of all of those people, but it would really hurt a lot of those casual employees, because instead of taking all of their money with them, which is the purpose of a defined contribution plan, and making it portable, they would be losing half of the value of the employer's half of the contributions. So we would not support it, and I'm sure.
Any questions of staff or Mr. Stanton or Mr. Janikowski? Is there anybody else here who wants to be heard on Senate file? Let's see, what is it? 1267, House File 1528. Is there anybody else who's here on this one? Okay. Is there a discussion? Representative Kahn?
Just a point to make is that, and I did get an email from one faculty member who really pointed out the sense of making this decision at the time of tenure rather than making an irrevocable decision within 1 year. It really fits in with how faculty think. So I think this is a good bill and we should pass it. So I'll move it, that it be included in the omnibus.
Okay, there were no amendments. So then Representative Kahn moves, Senate File 1267, House File 1528 be incorporated into the omnibus pension bill. Is there discussion on that motion? Hearing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, motion prevails. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members.
Okay, I'll tell you what, Senator Pappas is not back yet, so we will go to number one on the agenda, Senate File 506, House File 592. This is their teachers' retirement provisions modifications. Let's see, Mr. Martin, could you give us a review of what this bill does?
Members, if you take a look at the item two in your packets, the summary page or the first page of the memo try and set forth the six things that are done in this bill. In the future, starting in fiscal year 2012, state aid for school districts and other educational employers is increased ultimately by 2% of the fiscal year 2012 covered salary figure to offset the employer contributions that are in the bill. The retirement age for TRA and the other teacher plans is reduced from 66 to 65. The member contributions are increased in four annual installments starting in 2011. Up to 2% beyond what they are currently. The employer contributions are also increased by 2% cumulatively. There is authority added for the retirement boards to adjust the contribution rates if at the end of, after 2014, the pension plan is insufficiently funded, has a contribution deficiency. And the contribution rate increases can be 0.25% per year. And then the benefit accrual rates are also increased for TRA and the First Class City Teacher Plans.
Why don't we hear from TRA and find out the background and the need for the bill? Ms. Hacking, Mr. Thompson, welcome back to the Pension Commission. Please identify yourself for the record.
Lori Hacking, Director of the TRA and accompanying Mr. Thompson. Thanks so much for
move the mic a little bit there.
Okay, sorry. Is that better?
Yes.
We're here today to indicate strong support for this bill. Our board has reviewed it and supports it. We have worked jointly with Education Minnesota really over the past 2 years to come up with a good and workable benefit reform design. The bill has two goals, and I'm going to be working from a one-pager that you have that looks like this. The bill has two goals. The first is to restore financial stability to TRA. The second is to try to address what are really long-standing benefit inequities in our pension structure, particularly affecting teachers who were hired after 1989. I'm going to speak briefly to the provisions of this and stand for any questions. With respect to financial stability, put very simply, TRA needs additional funding. The market downturn of the past year and a half, combined with the need for us to absorb a much larger post-fund deficit than we anticipated, has really hurt us financially. At the end of fiscal 08, we stood with a 3.3% of payroll deficiency, and that deficiency could grow larger as the markets have gone down further. So it's critical that we get some contribution increases to start addressing that deficiency. Any inordinate delay in increasing contribution rates is going to make the financial problem worse. It will start to compound. So the proposal before you is to increase both employer and employee contributions by 2% each for a total of 4%. The rates would rise from where they are currently at 5.5%. They would rise over a four-year period of 0.5% each year up to 7.5%. Again, phased in gradually over 4 years starting in July 1st of 2011. We'd love to see these increases start sooner, but we realize the state faces fiscal challenges, and we wanted to give policymakers some time to plan for this. The revenue increase under this bill would be approximately $22 million for each year. In each year for both teachers and teachers and employers. School districts feel very strongly, and we understand this, that they would like to see some school aid increase to offset their costs. And that is incorporated in the bill. Minnesota has been very responsible about funding its large pension plans, and we are lucky. We've avoided many of the problems that you do see in other states, which have put off funding their obligations. In fact, in TRA's history, we faced such a problem like of this magnitude back in the 70s and 80s, and the legislature increased contribution rates, particularly employer rates, to a level as high as 9%. And that, combined with very good investment returns in the mid-80s and the late 90s, got us back to full funding. And that 9% rate then was dropped dramatically in 1997-98 to 5% because we reached full funding. So it's time again for us to evaluate this and get additional contributions in so that we can restore stability. After these contribution rates are phased in, we would pause and evaluate whether there remains a deficiency. If markets have not recovered, we expect there will be a remaining deficiency. However, if they have recovered, it's possible that no further contribution increases are needed. In either case, there is an automatic stabilizer put in the bill that is identical to the authority that PERA and MSRS have, and that would allow contribution rates to be adjusted in the future gradually, just 0.25% per year on the employee and employer side, again, equally shared, and rates could go up or down, again, depending upon the financial situation under that stabilizer. With respect to the pension reforms, many of you have heard from teachers over the years about the benefit inequities between pre- and post-89 hires. And you've heard a lot of teachers asking for the rule of 90, which post-89 hires do not have. This bill is not a rule of 90 bill. It is structured very differently, and we think it's a better structure that allows flexibility both for teachers who may need to go retire somewhat earlier and teachers who do want to continue working. The bill has three elements. The first element in the benefit reform is to increase the formula multiplier to 2.1%, and that is a prospective change for future years of service, and it would benefit all teachers, whether early or later retirement. There is also an important provision that for a teacher, a career teacher with 30 or more years of service, they would be able to retire at age 62, the normal retirement age of 62, without any reduction in their benefit. They could go out somewhat earlier, but they'd have to take a reduction in their benefit in order to do that. And the third element is to lower the normal retirement age from age 66, which is where it stands for post-89 hires, to age 65. And that, again, would benefit all teachers. The cost of this is 1.9% of payroll, and the employee contribution increase of 2% would cover that additional cost. I want to add here that St. Paul and Duluth funds are both included in this bill, both in the contribution increases as well as the benefit changes. So just to wrap up, it's very critical for TRA to get this bill and to get back on track for full funding. Waiting too long will start to increase the costs of addressing that deficit. Minnesota has had a very responsible history in the past of dealing with our deficits, so it's important that we move forward with this. We think this is a phased, measured approach that balances our current fiscal situation with our long-term financial needs. With that, Mr. Chair, I would entertain any questions, and I would just point out in your handout there are a number of groups which support this bill, 13 groups, and they're listed in your handout.
Thank you, Ms. Hacking. We are going to have I've asked to have copies of some of the actuarial summaries over the last few years prepared, because I think one question is going to be asked of us and other legislators is that some people say, well, didn't TRA have a surplus a couple of years ago? What happened to that? And Ms. Hacking, could you just kind of describe, because you talked about how we rolled back the contributions in 1997, 1998, and people are going to say, well, why are we in trouble now? So what happened?
Very good question. Yes, the rates were dramatically dropped to actually 5% employee and employer, because we had attained full funding as of that date. Since then, however, we've had one market downturn in 2001-2002. That harmed us somewhat, but we still maintained our fiscal balance. But this last downturn has been very severe and has taken its toll. We continued to be fully funded through 2005. Starting in 2006 is when we started to run a deficiency, and that combined with the subsequent market downturn that we have been experiencing and are absorbing the post-fund deficit, which turned out to be much larger than we were expecting when we put together the post-fund bill, that is really what has caused the serious deficiency that we have now. And I might point out, we are affected by market downturns more so than PARA and MSRS, because a higher proportion of our liabilities are on the retiree side. We have a very mature system. Our people stay, teachers stay, their career, they're likely to vest, they will collect benefits, whereas in PARA and MSRS's case, there is more turnover in their systems. They, too, are affected by the market downturn, but not as dramatically as TRA is.
And I'm sure the members of the Pension Commission understand this, but for other people, you know, who are following this and people here today, we did merge the active and post funds last year because the sufficiency going down. But as far as any ways to, I think, correct the direction TRA is going right now, you would either need a funding from the legislature, which is not going to happen. I mean, we're not going to send you money to help right the ship. A dramatic change in the stock market, you know, would be nice, but I don't think that's going to happen in the near term. So about the only other place you can go are employer-employee contribution increases. Is that a fair summary?
Mr. Chair, that is.
Okay. And obviously, and we've all been contacted, and people still have the interest in the Rule of 90, which you talked about. As I recall, the last time we looked at that, it would be about $1 billion, I think, to pay for the Rule of 90. Do you remember what the number was, Ms. Hacking?
It would be 1% of payroll, so that's approximately $38
million. $38
million,
okay.
A year,
okay, which we don't have, so okay. Okay, any questions of Mr. Thompson? Do you want to address this as well, too?
Mr. Chair, I just had a couple quick comments about, you know, the way the structure was put together. I mean, Ms. Hacking did say it was a measured approach, and we think it's consistent with the pension principles. Certainly, taking into consideration the current economic conditions, the long-term needs of public education, and certainly the emerging workforce patterns. There were three criteria that really went into discussing the benefit reforms, and this has been a process over really the last 2 years. The first was efficiency, that we felt that whatever contributions came in should result in the maximum benefit. And when you refer to the Rule of 90, too often you might be paying for benefits that people might not take advantage of, and that means there were an inefficient use of those tax dollars. A second criterion was equity, that we wanted it to be equitable in terms of those who benefit would be the ones who paid. And the last one really was relevance. We didn't want to go back and look at what was relevant in 89. We wanted to look at what was relevant 20 and 30 years into the future, because we do feel that TRA does matter for the future of public education in the state. It does matter for the recruitment and retention of teachers. There are serious issues in the inner city as well as in outstate Minnesota. They have unique needs, and this package is flexible in terms of allowing those unique needs to be addressed. It can contrast with some of the ideas about the Rule of 90 and the parity. It is fairer in that if people, career teachers, do have an interruption in their career pattern for health reasons or family reasons, and they come back 10 years later and begin teaching, and they retire at age 62 or 63, this benefits them far more than the Rule of 90 or any of those provisions would ever have done. And as Ms. Hacking has pointed out, waiting doesn't save money here. It really increases the cost dramatically, both in terms of the cost of the deficiency and the cost of any future benefit reforms, so that by waiting, you don't save money. This is a bill that exists out there that has to be paid at some point, that liability for the retirees is already there, and that by delaying or not addressing that equity issue for teachers, you really will have a negative qualitative impact on the future of public education. Any other questions, we'd be happy to answer.
And we do have a number of people who want to testify in this, but let's get any questions addressed of these witnesses. Representative Kahn.
I'm not sure if it's to the witnesses or the staff, but I'm just interested in this. When Social Security normal retirement is 66 or 67, is that still the same target for eligibility for Medicare? So if people retire at age 65, they're not eligible for what is the eligibility for Medicare?
The eligibility, Mr. Chair, Representative Kahn, eligibility age for Medicare has not changed. It remains 65. There's always a potential that the federal government could change that, but at this point,
but it would never change it retroactively. So.
Well,
sorry.
Who knows? Who knows? Okay. Any other questions of these witnesses?
Okay.
As I say, we do have a couple other people who do want to testify here. So if not, then let's call upon them. Mr. Dewar, Tom Dewar. Well, I'll just indicate the people who have indicated they want to testify. Charles Hiley, Roger Aronson, Carrie Lucking, and Neil Whitico. Those are the individuals who indicated they want to testify. There's others, you know, you need to let us know. Welcome to the Pensions Commission. Please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the Commission, my name is Tom Dewar. I'm President of Education Minnesota, here representing the 70,000 educators of Minnesota, and it's a pleasure to have this opportunity to speak to you today. As I said, we represent 70,000 educators, and we have several of our state governing board members here also today, and I urge your support of Senate File 506 and House File 592. These bills are important elements in increasing our ability to attract and retain good people in the education profession. As you know, the Minnesota teaching force is in nation leading. This is evidenced by the strong student achievement that we have and the results for which our state is known. This pension reform helps us maintain that quality. It's clear that attracting and retaining high-quality teachers should be the primary goal of our school districts, and for that matter, should be the primary goal of our state. With about 50% of our teachers leaving the profession within the first 5 years, we need to do everything we can to make sure the profession is as attractive as possible, so good people will come and they will stay in education as our children's teachers. In a nutshell, it comes down to keeping Minnesota in a competitive position. We have a quality teaching force now, and we need to have one in the future. When it comes to pensions, two major issues are facing Minnesota teachers: the equity of their benefits and the financial stability of their pension funds. Education Minnesota is working with the Teachers Retirement Association this session to pass legislation that would address the stability of the retirement fund and correct the basic inequities in the Minnesota retirement system that penalize many of our educators. First, let me address the equity issue. For teachers today, there are two different formulas in calculating their retirements. There are two different levels of benefits. Basically, if you were hired before 1989, you have one level, and if you were hired after 1989, your benefits are less. Those teachers hired after 1989 now make up a full 70% of our active teaching force in Minnesota. And it's common sense that the basic inequity does not help attract quality teachers to the profession or help keep them here. The key question is, why should there be a difference between benefit pensions with teachers hired before 1989 and those hired after? The teachers we are hiring today and in the future do not have equal benefits to their veteran colleagues, and it all adds up to a competitive disadvantage that I've been talking about. We simply must fix this inequity, and you can help fix it by passing this legislation. Now I'll talk for a moment about the stability. We simply must restore financial stability to Minnesota's teacher pension funds for the good of our state and for its teachers. The economic and market downturns have had a significant impact on the Teachers Retirement Association funding levels, and the long-term sustainability is essential for TRA and its members. This legislation offers a phased and measured approach that balances current fiscal realities with the need for stable teacher pension funds. It puts the teacher retirement funds back on the path to full funding with a workable and affordable plan. First, employees and employers will share the responsibility for funding. Teachers will pay for the benefit improvements, while increased employee and employer contributions stabilize the fund. Second, teacher and employer contribution increases to stabilize the fund would be phased in by 0.5% per year for 4 years, beginning in 2011, making the plan affordable for all involved. Finally, the benefit improvements would boost Minnesota's low national pension ranking, providing equity for teachers hired after 1989 and help districts attract and retain quality teachers. As you know, waiting to fix this problem will only increase the cost to do it later. This legislature has the opportunity to increase our state's competitiveness and create a win-win situation for Minnesota's teachers and schools. Education Minnesota and TRA stand ready to put together a package that works for everyone. Please support the fiscally responsible teacher pension reform by passing Senate File 506 and House File 592. For our nation-leading teachers, they deserve nothing less.
Thank you. And Mr. Dewar, just to be clear, because I'm sure we're all going to be asked about this, I don't know how the budget issues are going to be resolved this legislative session. That remains to be seen. So far, there doesn't seem to be any plan to have any new long-range money put into education, and if it was there, it would go to the classroom, not necessarily to pension. So you are representing that your members understand that they would be paying more. They're going to get benefit increases, but they are going to have to pay more for their pensions.
Yeah, Mr. Okay. Chairman, they understand that.
Okay, thank you. Any questions? Okay. I also have Valerie Dosslin also wish to testify. So if the other individual I called off could come forward, Charles Hiley, Roger Aronson, Charles Lucking, Neil Whitico, and Valerie Dossland. Welcome to the Pension Commission. Please identify yourself for the record.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Charles Helley, and I'm president of REAM, Retired Educators Association of Minnesota. We have about 9,000 retired educators in our organization. REAM strongly backs this bill. We believe mm-hmm. this bill addresses pension equity for yeah. educators hired after June 30th, 1989. This pension equity is long overdue.
They come a lot of times.
This bill will help attract and retain educators for a strong educational system for the 21st century. Moving from 1.9% to 2.1% for each year of credit beginning in 2011 will move Minnesota's pension plan from the bottom upward when compared with other state pension plans. This balanced package provides shared employee and employer responsibility and will result in stabilizing the TRA fund. The average employer contribution is 9.5% in other states. Minnesota is presently at 5.5% and would gradually move to 7.5% by 2014. Thank you.
Any questions?
Okay. Mr. Chairman, members, my name is Roger Ernst, and I represent the Minnesota Elementary School Principals Association and the Minnesota Association of Secondary School Principals. Elementary, middle, senior high principals, and assistant principals. We have about 1,700 members throughout Minnesota. And I'm not going to repeat the details of the bill that you've heard before, but let me give you a couple things that maybe you haven't heard. First of all, we want to thank TRA for the work that they've done, coming and talking to our members, educating us, going over the details in an attempt to put together a plan that can serve teachers and principals and the state. They've done a very good job of that. It's taken a lot of education piece on the part of TRA, and I think on us as well, to say we need to do something that isn't the rule of 90, because when you say it's not the rule of 90, it's something else, that makes people very nervous. But we believe that this is a very good plan. We do understand that a significant separable component of this is the need to stabilize TRA so that that's an effective tool that continues to support folks who retire through the public education system. There's another component to this as well, and we think that moving that retirement age from 66 down to those who would be eligible to 62 will help us in schools. There are some significant advantages, not for everyone, but for a lot of employees. To allow them to retire at 62 and that we can replace them, both school principals and school teachers, with some folks that are coming in at the other end that are very energetic, and that we continue to refresh that pool of people and attract new people into the profession of education in Minnesota so that we can succeed at that. And it sounds like a minor policy matter here, but actually it's a very significant one that we think is very, very important in this part of the bill. So, Mr. Chairman, again, we appreciate the opportunity to come in and testify on behalf of the bill. And again, I do want to reinforce that TRA has done a very good job of educating our members as well and making us aware of what the issues are here. And we strongly urge your support for 506 and 592. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
And a question that I asked Mr. Doerr a few minutes ago, I mean, the principals are aware that this would mean an employer contribution increase as well.
Mr. Chairman, absolutely. I mean, okay. It is, and there's no way around that. We had one with the roll-in of Minneapolis a couple of years ago, and
sure.
And so folks are aware of that, yes.
With no guarantee there's going to be any long-term state funding coming in the near future.
Mr. Chairman, I think your comments were right to the extent of as monies are available, and as you know, all of us on this side sit in the K-12 area as well, as to what the priorities would be for spending those. I think
okay.
We understand those, yes.
Any
sure.
questions of Mr. Aronson? Okay. I also have Kurt Schneiderwind, who wants to testify too, so our next witness, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the Commission. My name is Valerie Doslin, and I represent the Minnesota Association of School Administrators. And like the other folks who spoke before me, we strongly support this legislation. MASA believes that it's a fair and responsible approach. It addresses the disparity for the post-1989 employees, and it helps stabilize the TRA fund. MASA, I believe you all received a letter from Charlie Kite, the executive director. One, we hope that this is paid for, whether it's through state aid or potentially a local discretionary levy through school districts.
Okay, any questions? Mr. Doslin? Okay, thank you. And our next witness?
Mr. Chair, my name is Kirk Schneider. I went on staff with the Minnesota School Boards Association, and we would like to lend our conditional support for this bill as well. And I think that conditional support depends on the revenue available for school districts to provide the funding for this piece. I think most of the testifiers before me have touched on the importance in the policy discussion about blending and finding a middle ground for early retirement incentives, and I believe this approach does that. The TRA staff have done a fine job of making sure that that's workable for everybody, and they've informed us of the whole process as we've moved along here. And it's important to understand, and I don't need to reinforce this because I know some teachers will probably reinforce this. It is a very challenging profession, and I think it's important that we provide the funding for those teachers, not only in salary but also in benefits. And I think that this piece provides that middle ground approach. While we value the importance of our senior staff, I think that the discussion is if there's an early retirement piece, then we're able to freshen the pool and freshen the blood in the education profession, so to speak. So I think it's also important to note, and Ms. Doslin touched on the issue of levy authority, and I think it's important that's why we're supporting this piece, because Section 1 has the state funding for this, where our brothers and sisters in the city and county local governments have the authority to raise revenue locally to pay for those pension benefits. And I understand the conditions economically are very difficult right now, and so it's important that we have that piece to fund this program.
Well, of course, the levy authority issues ultimately are decided in the tax committees in the within the House and the Senate. So, but I just wanted to ask you the same question, too, because prior to the session, when I made the rounds with my school boards in my area, I did try to put this on the radar screen, and I said TRA, you know, is probably going to be looking for some help, and they may be looking for employer increases, and I'm not sure the state is going to be able to contribute towards that. So you're saying that the school boards are aware that this is coming, and they're in support of this.
Mr. Chair, I think it's conditional support on the fact that there's state funding or a funding source available for school districts to pay for that.
Okay. Any questions? Okay, next witness.
Chairman and members of the commission, my name is Neil Whitico. I teach English, German, and television production at Hermantown High School, and I've been a teacher for 26 years, proudly serving in Representative Murphy's district. In 1997, I had the honor of being named Minnesota Teacher of the Year. I'm also a member of Education Minnesota's governing board, which represents more than 70,000 Minnesota educators. We're here today to speak on behalf of teachers of all stages of their careers, those who have dedicated many years of their life to teaching and guiding Minnesota students, and those who are just beginning in the classroom. We believe that the reforms proposed in this bill will go a long way to fix the inequities in the teacher pension system and address the concerns of teachers at both ends of the career spectrum. As a career teacher, I'm concerned about the people coming after me. This is why we support the bill. It will help to ensure that Minnesota schools can continue to attract and retain great teachers for our students. This bill also addresses the inequity that has been a part of Minnesota's pension system for far too long. All teachers work hard to meet the needs of their students, whether this is their first year in the profession or their last, and they should all be entitled to the same benefits, no matter what year they were hired. This bill ensures that teachers hired after 1989 receive benefits comparable to those of us who were hired earlier. In my school district in Hermantown, 101 out of 129 teachers were hired after 1989, so this proposal affects them significantly. We also recognize that these are hard times, and we think that this bill is a responsible solution. The contribution changes would not go into effect until 2011, and then they are phased in over 4 years. This is a win-win for teachers, for Minnesota, and for all students. Thank you for your time and consideration.
Representative Murphy, any comments?
He's one of my favorites.
I get you. I thought so. Okay. Thank you. Our next witness.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the commission, my name is Carrie Lucking. I'm a social studies teacher at Hopkins High School, and I've been teaching for 12 years. I was a nominee for Minnesota Teacher of the Year, and I'm also a member of the Education Minnesota Governing Board.
And did he beat you up?
Actually, I had Senator Pappas' daughter in class the year that Neil was Minnesota Teacher of the Year. As a teacher who's still in the earlier years of my career, I understand the importance of attracting and retaining quality teachers who can carry on Minnesota's tradition of excellence when outstanding people like Neil retire. We used to be able to recruit teachers despite low salaries by offsetting that with good benefits and a great retirement. That is not necessarily the case any longer. Teachers are also concerned that we have a fair pension system, but we understand that we share the responsibility for fixing it. We're ready to step up to the plate and be a part of the solution. We're willing to pay our share of the cost of stabilizing the fund and improving benefits and the fund for all teachers, and that is what this bill provides. All teachers want to know that when we reach retirement age, there will be a strong pension fund there to support us after many years of commitment and hard work. Senate File 506 and House File 592 address the deficiency in the pension fund and make the fund sustainable over the long term so all teachers can count on retirement. We know the problems in the pension system won't go away by themselves and that they can only get worse if we do nothing. Neil and I ask you to support House File 592 and Senate File 506.
Thank you. Any questions of this witness? Is there anybody else who's here who wants to be heard on this bill? Members, we had passed out the actuarial sheets just for your information, and about maybe a quarter of the way down on each sheet shows the funding ratio, and you can see for TRA in 2004 it had a 100% funding, and it went down subsequent year to 98%, 92%, 93%, 87% until 2008, 81.99%. Likewise, we have similar sheets for Duluth. 2002, it was 100%. 2008 is 82%. And then St. Paul Teachers in 2002, they were at 78%. They actually dropped down to 69% in 05 and 06 and actually got back up now to 75%. So you can kind of see where the trends have been.
And Mr. Chair, just on that point, it's important to know, just like we talked about with in the MRF discussion last week, in 2007, there's actually, because we changed the way we accounted for stuff,
right. There's
actually two columns there, so there was actually a significant drop because of that as well.
Right. Representative Murphy.
Mr. Chair, members, I would like just affirmation from Duluth and St. Paul.
Sure.
They were alluded to, but I'd like to hear their voices say that they're for it.
Okay. Mr. Southwell, welcome back to the Pension Commission.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and Representative Murphy, thank you for your invitation. I am here to speak. My name is Jay Stoffel, Director of the Duluth Teachers Retirement Fund, and I can speak on behalf of my board that we do support the bill. In the current form that it's in, with the contribution rate increase and the benefit increase, as it's presented in the bill.
Any questions, Mr. Kapler?
Mr. Chairman, members, the St. Paul Teachers Retirement Fund Association Board also is in favor of the bill. Contingent on funding being provided, we're planned with an ongoing deficiency and a significant unfunded liability and our board is nervous about adding to that with a benefit increase that isn't funded somehow. And with our members already making more than normal cost contributions, they're averse to the idea of it all being loaded onto the members of the plan. But they are in favor of the bill, broad concepts, and the specific features within it in terms of the benefit enhancement.
And so for the St. Paul teachers, their contribution would go from what to what then?
It would increase the same rate, potentially 2% over the 4-year period.
Well, everybody's going to get 2%. Okay. Any questions of St. Paul or Duluth teachers? Okay. Mr. Stoffel.
Mr. Chairman, if I might just point out that the cost of the bill for Duluth is a little bit higher just because we're trying to get some uniformity in the pre-89 folks, taking them to 1.9. We don't have in your packet, it's pointed out that there isn't any actuarial calculations made for Duluth. We are trying to be very careful about how we spend our money these days, given the situation. We ran some cost estimates last year that are very close to the package that's in front of you today. So I can provide you with those actuarial cost numbers. Rounding everything up and giving you a good idea, it's going to be about a 2% cost. I think TRA said 1.9. For us, it's about 2% cost. So it's very similar, but a little bit more expensive because of that one feature.
Okay. Does staff have any more comments, Mr. Martin? Anything further?
Members, affordability is a major consideration that we laid out in the staff memo. We also pointed out to the longstanding Pension Commission policy of having pension plans that look for benefit improvements to have their funding house in order before they seek a benefit improvement and to be fully funded after the benefit improvement. And that's somewhat in doubt or somewhat nuanced in this case.
Of course, in this particular case, it'd be a little difficult to have the employees pay more for the same. I think that's part of the conundrum that we're in on this one. So, anything the other members wish to, Sarah Lynch?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. More of a kind of a process question. How does the discussion, if this proposal is successful in the Pension Commission, how does it move forward into the overall finance piece of both respective bodies?
There's a what we do in this commission is that we assemble an omnibus bill, which is actually a draft of a bill. And we'll review that, and when we're ready to go with that, which would be at our next meeting, I hope, then we'll designate a carrier bill that is currently in the Senate GovOps Committee and the companion of the House GovOps Committee as the vehicle bills. And so they'll be amended. What we do in this committee will be amended. Commission will be amended onto those bills. And then the House GovOps Committee and the Senate GovOps Committee will bring those bills up for hearing. They will then pass out of those policy committees. Presumably the next stop would be, it's going to depend upon the body, but they're going to have to go through the Senate Finance Committee. And if there's levy authority in here, the Senate Tax Committee. And the House, I guess it would go to Ways and Means, Finance, and Taxes. I don't know that there's other committees along the way that may need to see the bill, but that is ultimately for the levy authority. The tax committees in each body would have to get the bill, and they would have to review that, if that's a proposal on how to fund it. Representative Kahn.
I know what we've sometimes done is when the proposals have gone together, there have been a set of parts of the omnibus bill that have no fiscal impact and a set that have fiscal impact. And as I recall, we've divided them into two bills, one of which goes from GovOps right to the floor and one of which goes through the finance committees. I'm not sure what...
One of the options that we could have, and we don't need to make the decision today, but if we're desired to just split off the TRA bill and have that go separately, that's a possibility. It doesn't matter. I mean, for me, I've got to make a trip to the tax committee anyway, so it doesn't matter whether I take the TRA bill or the whole omnibus bill. It's I've got to bring it there. So at some point... I got to make the trip in the Senate, and Representative Murphy is going to have to make the similar trip in the House. So, one way or the other, they're going to get it. But as I'm thinking here right now, it just makes more sense to roll the TRA bill into the full omnibus bill and just carry it full as a package. Hopefully, Murph will be in there at some point, but we don't know where that's going to be yet. So, Representative Murphy.
Senator Betzel, Representative Thiessen. I hate to bring it out, but mm-hmm. What if the economy keeps on bombing and we get to 2011 and we can't?
Mr. Chair,
I think
I would say a couple things. The first is the benefit increases are designed to go into effect coordinated with the start of the contribution increases. So, over the next 2 years, If it looks like we can't afford this, we can look for other options for funding, or we're not kind of setting ourselves up so the benefit, they will be going into effect, but, we can always revisit stuff. I don't know if that answers your question, but they're coordinated to go into effect at the same time.
Okay. Officer Murphy.
Senator Betzel, Representative Thiessen, is there anything else that hasn't been mentioned today that you had in your remarks or as you're going along that we should hear?
I think that everybody has said most of well, I'm happy to answer any questions I can answer, but I guess I would just commend everybody that's worked on this bill to pull it together, TRA and Education Minnesota and everybody else, because it has been a...
And as one who office is just down the hall from yours, and I've seen people waiting outside of your office and sitting in your office around that open space that you have, it's, I think, my gosh, you've done so much work on this, and I appreciate it.
Senator Lynch.
Mr. Chair, and to Representative Murphy's comment, I think there is one thing that needs to be said again and again and again, and that is what the state aid increases are. And they are significant. They are, I think, warranted, but, you know, $23 million, $47 million the next, $70 the next, $94. I think that that is worth mentioning again and again and again. Because this is an example of support that is given for public education in the state of Minnesota that isn't necessarily seen or recognized on the street. So I think it's important that we state that and recognize that as such again and again and again.
Senator Betzel.
Representative Murphy.
Senator Betzel, Representative Lynch, I totally agree with you, and we've got to, that's got to be part of our message as we go along. But we also have to include in our message that there, right now, there are a group of teachers that are getting part of that total amount. And then a significant, as Mr. Ritico pointed out, in his case, a large majority of their teachers that aren't eligible for part of that increase. And that is not fair either. And so we've got to develop our message with the total numbers and the total how we're balancing it up and making it right for all of our teacher employees.
Representative Thiessen.
Oh, and just to Senator Lynch, I think that is important, that this piece in investment is investment in public education coming from the legislature in the state of Minnesota in light of everything else that's out there. So I agree with what you're saying.
Sarah Rosen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I know I'm new on this commission, but I look at this proposal, and not that it doesn't deserve merit, but is this ripe for a veto if it's put into the omnibus pension bill?
Well, obviously, we can't speak for the governor. I haven't heard anything yet that there's concerns, but, you know, we're still going through the process.
And, Mr.
If,
Chair.
Yeah, if the governor's got any concerns, we hope that there'd be some proposals as to how to correct the problem. I mean, you can look at the numbers, and they're not good in the direction TRA is going. If it continues to worsen, it's going to be much more expensive down the road to figure out. Those of us who were around when Minneapolis teachers, you know, got down to, what, 58%, that was a huge problem to try to correct, and I don't think we want to go through that again. Representative Thiessen?
And Mr. Chair and Senator Rosen, you're absolutely right, and we've already – there's been some initial engagement with the administration on this, but quite clearly we're going to have to continue that work as we go forward.
Senator Rosen.
And thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Thiessen, may perhaps that does then satisfy the argument to send it separately and not put it into the omnibus bill. Okay. Because I would hate to jeopardize that entire bill.
Sure. Well, you know, and we got to keep in mind the employees are going to be paying more for this. So they're kicking in. And we got to be cognizant of the issues of the school board, but something's got to happen. And unless we can come up with either a better stock market or a state appropriation, I can't think of any other funding source. So, Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess to Senator Lynch's question, and I think you're touching a little bit what I was thinking here also, even if we don't have the benefit increase, even if we don't have the contribution increase by the employees, if the stock market and the economy doesn't change turn around, the state's going to be obligated to some of those additional costs at some point of to make these pensions whole, because it's a promise out there that we're, and we can't let these pensions go down the tubes. And there's going to be people that are going to be collecting these and expecting these, and we're going to have that obligation. It's better to take care of it now at the early end than, as you said, like the Minneapolis teacher's pension. If we let it go too long, it's going to be a bigger problem that we're going to have to face later on.
Representative Kahn.
Well, Mr. Chairman and Senator Rosen, I mean, this is coming out awfully early. I would hope that if the governor has concerns at those, I would hope that he would engage in the process, and I would hope that those concerns would be directed to us as early as possible. I mean, it's not exactly like this is coming out of the blue, you know, at the end of the session in a take-it-or-leave-it mode. So,
anything else? Again, is there anybody else who's here who wants to be heard on Senate File 506, House File 592? Is there Representative Thiessen? You authored the bill in the House.
I'll move it. It's inclusion in the omnibus pension.
Okay, and there were no amendments, so Representative Thiessen moves that Senate File 506, House File 592 be incorporated in the omnibus pension bill. Now, again, maybe if the desire is later on to split it out separately, that opportunity will be there. But for the moment, we'll incorporate it and see what happens, okay? On that motion, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
And those opposed, the motion prevails. Thank you very much. Okay, let's head back to Senate File 686, St. Paul Teachers Post-Retirement Adjustment Procedure. Senator Pappas are back, so let's pick up where we left off.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think there was a technical amendment that we wanted to add.
Right. We weren't sure. We checked back with the minutes of the March 6th meeting. We did not adopt any minutes or any amendments to that. And there was a
Mr. Chairman.
Which tab is this?
Ms. Burke.
What tab is this?
I would just want to point out to the commission that if the commission wants to consider other amendments, it does not need the technical amendment.
Oh.
It would be only if the commission wanted to adopt the bill.
Don't you have tabs?
Without any other.
As written, okay. With some technical cleanup that technical amendment, that would be the 1A amendment. Okay. Would be needed.
And I think that's the reason why we held back, because the other amendments could affect that. So I don't think there's a need to do it at this time. Let's see where the discussion goes.
Mr.
Okay.
Chairman.
Mr.
Chairman, it's my position that the two-year pilot worked, but that the new proposal, which takes out any consideration of investment returns, is superior. And so my intention would be to adopt the technical amendment and move the bill as amended.
Okay. Let's just review, Mr. Burke, what were some of the options that we had? I mean, when we've got amendments here just to extend,
Mr. Chairman,
the pilot and then study it over the interim. What are other things did we talk about March 6th?
Mr. Chairman, I created a short memo, which is the memo immediately before you with the tab number 5. I wrote it on March 19th.
Okay.
And that memo lays out the various options which have been identified. The first one there, and that's on the first page, number 1, if you take no action on the bill, it does not mean that the St. Paul teachers don't have a post-retirement adjustment. If you take no action on the bill, it simply means that the provision in statute will again become operative. And what that statutory provision is that it would provide an automatic 2% increase plus additional increases equal to the excess, if any, of the 5-year annualized return above 8.5%, with some minor adjustments for contribution deficiency. So there will be a provision in place even if you take no action. Now, number 2,
it just reverts back to what it was, which is why we
correct,
because we had some concerns about having them pay out 5% and when they couldn't afford it. So we'd go right back to that point, which is got us here in the first place. Okay.
So number 2 are the various actions if you take
action on the bill with the amendments that have been prepared. So 2A is the bill as it stands, which would, and that provides an inflation match up to 5% regardless of the investment returns. And I would suggest if you take that approach that you use the 1A amendment. The 1A amendment is just technical cleanup. Now, the 2B there is the bill with amendment 3A. And what that would do is it would index adjustments to the adjustments provided by the Social Security Administration with a 5% cap. So that does tie you to the adjustments that Social Security provides. So if Social Security system changes its method or places some cap or other limitation, this plan would have that same adjustment. The 2C simply, and that would be with the 4A amendment, that provides a flat 2.5% increase. And that is the same increase that is provided by TRA. So the 2C amendment, an advantage of that is it treats St. Paul teachers the same as the TRA teachers. And I would submit to you that that is less expensive than a system that provides an inflationary adjustment up to 5%, provided that inflation as we go forward is on average going to be more than 2.5%. Basically, any variable stream of inflation, I mean, it's high in some years, it's low in others, but that can all be equated to a consistent increase in each year. And if that consistent increase is equal to 5.5%, it's the same as in terms of cost as the state the system used for the statewide teachers. If it turns out to be more than 2.5, it's going to be somewhat more expensive to simply do an inflationary match. 2D would provide an inflationary match, but it would cap it at 2.5%. That's the cheapest of the alternatives before you. This would be the least expensive because you couldn't pay more than 2.5, and there would be years where you pay less. So it's certainly going to be less expensive than option C there. The 2E would take the temporary program that was enacted in 2007, and it would extend it 1 year through 2010. And what that program did is it provided a match of inflation up to 2.5%, notwithstanding investment returns, and you could have a match up to 5% if both the 1 year and 5 year annualized returns were at least 8.5%. So that's the system in the 2007 law, and what the what Amendment 11A would do is it would simply leave that system in place for one more year. That could give the Commission additional time to consider where it wants to go with both this plan and the other plans. And 2F is the same concept, taking the 2007 provisions, but extending them for 2 years. Now, we also had passed out earlier a 13A amendment and a 14A amendment. These two amendments were requested fairly late yesterday by Mr. Kapler, so they weren't included in the under this particular item, but we're handling that separately. What the 13A amendment does is it would take the 2007 system, the laws that were enacted in 2007, and it would extend it 1 year, but it would also do away with a requirement in those in that law that both the 1 year and 5 year return has to exceed 8.5% in order to match inflation above 2.5%. Now, if you do want to use this amendment, I do need to suggest a further oral amendment to you to make it work. The 14A amendment extends that 2007 program for 2 years, and it eliminates, is intended anyway, to eliminate the requirement that they, the plan has to have both a one-year and a five-year return, which exceeds 8.5% in order to provide an increase above 2.5%, leaving in place only the requirement that the five-year return exceed 8.5%. And again, on this one, there is a further oral amendment I would need to suggest to you to make it work.
Mr. Chairman?
Just a second. Mr. Kapler, I just would note it doesn't help when you come in at 4:30 in the afternoon the day before and want some amendments drawn up. I think you could have come in a little earlier.
Senator Betzel, we weren't requesting additional amendments. What I received was an email from Pension Commission staff asking if there were any additional amendments that we were interested in or thought would be viable considerations to put for the Pension Commission to address the concerns that were raised at the last meeting. And in the course of the discussion with Mr. Burek, I suggested, you know, something that would be preferable to the 1 and 5 year trigger would be a simple 5 year investment performance trigger being attached and dropping the 1 year. We didn't come in soliciting with any earnestness additional amendments.
It was late over 2 weeks ago. I think we could have had some of the stuff done a little earlier. Mm-hmm. Senator Pappas.
Mr. Chairman, I guess I did not have a chance to talk to Mr. Kapler about the amendment, so okay. I just wanted to get more.
Let me, members, I think taking no action, you know, is probably a bad idea. I mean, we had some concerns before, so we have to do something. If we want to make a decision today, you know, we can certainly do that. If we just want to extend it out and study it more over the interim, we can do that too. But I got to get a sense of what the Pension Commission, you know, wants to do on this topic. If we you know, I did not put an end time for today, so if you want to resolve it today, we're going to stay until we have to have the thing resolved. So what do you want to do? Representative Kahn.
I gather that what they would really like is see the 2.5 thing that makes them equivalent to everything.
No.
Is that, no?
They are saying no.
They want
so.
Their bill.
They want what?
They want the bill as they presented it. Here and if that's it, then I guess the 1A amendment would have to clean it up. But Senator Pappas,
Mr. Chairman, maybe we should hear from other members of the commission before I say anything.
Well, let's, as I say, I don't get a sense of where the commission wants to do on this topic. So,
well,
Sarah Lynch,
Mr. Chair, Senator Pappas, I think it would be helpful to the commission to hear from you. That would be helpful.
Could you say it louder?
That would be helpful to me as a member of this commission to hear from you as the author on this. I'd be interested.
Well, I mentioned earlier that my preference would be to do the original bill with the technical amendment. If, you know, and I think if members are comfortable with that, we should do that. If members feel that they're not comfortable with that, then what we could do is we could try the new approach, which is just COLA-based, but put a 2-year sunset so that Mr. Kapler can come back again in 2 years and show us how he's done. You know, the last pilot worked very well. You know, they're moving in the right direction in terms of their funding ratio. And I think that this could be an even more superior approach that we could just try for 2 years.
But and just to refresh the commission members, you know, if you go back to the actuarial sheets, they were down to 69% 2 years ago, and so that's why, unlike the other two funds, they've actually gone. They went up to 73% and 75%. So I think that the actions that we took did help. I don't know if it solves the problems though, because I think the problem that they've got is they're still committed to making more benefits in the long run that they can afford, and at some point. There's not going to be a state appropriation to help them out, you know. So I ultimately, you know, we don't want them to get into trouble down the road. So we got whatever we do, it has to be the right thing here. And so, Mr. Kapler, are you convinced that whatever option we have here, or is the bill going to solve the problem, or what do you think?
Mr. Chairman, members. Yeah, we think the bill goes a long ways to solving the problem relative to the old formula in law. And we don't,
think that a flat 2.5%, which is a formula that's being applied to the state programs, necessarily results in a lower cost than the option that's being presented to you here, though we're not contending that it absolutely is the case that the COLA that you have in front of you matched to CPI and disassociated from investment earnings is going to result in lower cost than that 2.5 either. That's an uncertainty. It requires some ability to predict the future course of inflation, and if the experts can't decide what that's going to be over the course of the next 2 years, I'm not going to attempt to predict it over the next 25. It is a lower cost formula than what we have in current law, which is what we revert to if nothing happens, an infinitely lower cost formula program. The pilot program saved you based on the actuaries' analyses in the study that was mandated by the commission, $47 million in net present value terms for the current retiree set, just attributed to the difference between the COLAs we would have paid and those we did, compounded out over the expected retired life of the current set of retirees that we have. So you've definitely lowered the cost of this program, and you have helped this program already just for the 2 years under the pilot. And I think if there's enough concern or uneasiness or uncertainty on the part of the commission, and I guess we're not shocked by that. We're talking about a future scenario here that nobody can predict with any absolute certainty. The idea of extending the pilot, a modified pilot, adopting the proposal without the investment earnings triggers, and limiting that to 2 years and coming back and reconsidering it, that makes eminent good sense from our standpoint, and we think that would be more than a satisfactory outcome.
Representative Murphy.
Well, Mr. Chair, being the author of the first pilot, I lean more toward what Mr. Kapler just said, to have a second pilot using the stuff that's in this bill now. And I would feel more comfortable with that than just let it go on and report back, or, you know, we would see their report. I would like it called the pilot.
Representative Kahn.
Mr. Chairman, on the for either 13A or 14A, when you take out the phrase in 2.1, doesn't that just mean it's automatically going to go up to 5%?
I don't know. Mr. Burek, you had indicated.
Chairman,
go ahead.
What the language did in the 2007 law was it had two triggers.
Yes.
In order to go up to 5%, you had to have at least an 8.5% return in the most recent year and over the last 5 years. And what Mr. Kapler requested was that we revise this to remove the one-year trigger, so leaving in place the five-year. So what this language was intended to do is it would remove that one-year requirement and leave only the requirement that the fund had to earn at least 8.5% over the most recent five-year period.
Representative Kahn.
Chairman, looking at the second half of the memo, looking at the little table on the second half of the memo with the note that despite the negative return in 2008, and I guess we'll get another bad return in 2009, we're looking at the five-year annualized return is 11.27. Now, I don't know how you put what putting 2009 does in that, but it looks like at least for 2008, we'd be above that trigger automatically.
Mr. Chairman, that's correct. I was frankly quite surprised when I looked at the returns this association has earned. They've been much higher than I would have expected given the markets. And the five-year return ending in 2008 is 11.27%. So they are above 8.5.
But the point is taking out, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah, you'll be losing.
Taking out the second trigger means that you're not really extending the pilot. You're changing the pilot.
That's correct. So you would be changing the pilot because you're changing one of the requirements in it, yes.
But the bill as written without these amendments doesn't do that. It would just. But the bill as written goes forever, so suppose we wanted to really extend the pilot. Which
the bill as written differs from the pilot in that the bill as written has no investment triggers whatsoever. It simply says we're going to match inflation up to 5%, regardless of what you do in terms of your investment performance. Whereas the pilot program did have the stipulation that, well, you can go above 2.5, not to exceed 5, if your investment performance is high enough to hit this trigger.
And Mr. Chairman, I believe that with the state auditor's report, there was a recommendation to disassociate the increases with investment return, that because that was so volatile and so risky for the
fund. they're making 5% regardless of the results. You know, I mean, you can't just keep paying out benefits even if the investments don't support them. So
if you have a more modest benefit that's based on inflation rather than on investment returns, hopefully that's going to be more sustainable.
Well,
let's just do Senator Pappas's bill with a 2-year sunset on it.
Sounds good to me.
And that has no link to investment return. That has no link to investment return. No.
And we can never go back. I mean, that's the thing that's important to know.
Yeah.
And I mean, you probably have discussed that already, but okay, they seem comfortable with that.
If we did that, would we have to adopt the 1A technical amendment?
Yes.
Okay. Well, Mr. Chairman, I would suggest that, yes, and just with a direction to staff to need be to add some language limiting this to 2 years.
Okay, Mr. Kapler, what's your thoughts about that? Adopt the 1A technical amendment and have a 2-year sunset on this program.
Mr. Chairman, members, we think the technical amendment is a good one. It gets the language in better shape than it was delivered to the commission, you've tested it one way with investment-related triggers. This would put a test on it. I mean, it's a very narrow time frame, but it would put a test on it without the triggers. Given sort of the concerns and the apprehensions, and given these economic times, those apprehensions are not unfounded. I think that would be a wise and prudent course to follow. It gives you an opportunity to revisit an issue about which you do not have unqualified unanimity about right now, so it gives you an opportunity to decide again.
Is there anybody else who's here wants to be heard on this bill, these amendments? Okay, so Representative Thiessen, did you want to make that motion then to adopt?
Do you want?
I'll make it.
Yeah. Pappas?
I'll move the 1A amendment.
Okay, we'll start with and incorporate a sunset as part of that?
Incorporating a 2-year sunset.
And the 2 years would be,
Mr. Chairman, you could do it with the oral amendment to the bill, page 2, line 18. Okay. After 2009, insert, and expires on July 1, 2011.
It expires what date?
July 1, 2011.
Okay. Would June 30th be a better date? It's the end of the fiscal year?
June 30th.
June 30th, 2011. Okay.
Chair.
Representative Nelson.
So in June 30th, 2011, if we allow this to expire, do we go back to existing statute prior to the 2-year pilot we're in now?
Prior to this pilot, yes, it would go back and bounce back. They'd have to pay 5% regardless of the investments. Yes. Yes.
So we better revisit it.
I have a hunch, and we might even study this more over the interim, too, or some point. So, Mr. Kapler?
Mr. Chairman, technical question. If we're talking about the cost of living adjustments for the calendar years beginning on January 1, 2010 and January 1, 2011. I guess that makes sense. My question, I don't have any concerns with it. I think that works.
Okay.
I was just wondering about that June 30 date.
Well, I mean, at June 30 is the fiscal year. That's when a lot of things we do around here. So, anybody? Okay, so Senator Pappas has moved the 1A amendment, as well as to amend the bill to have the sunset date of June 30th, 2011 on page 2, line 18 of the bill. Is there discussion on that motion? Hearing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, the amendment is adopted. Senator Pappas
now
moves.
Senate File 686 is amended to be incorporated into the omnibus pension bill.
Is there discussion on that motion? Hearing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Those opposed, motion prevails. The next meeting will be Tuesday night, March 31st. Does that work?
Yes.
Okay. Tuesday night, March 31st, about 7 o'clock, this room. As I say, the plan will be to do technical. The staff will have the bill posted on the website, so if people have comments, they can get back to them. There are one or two issues that are popping up that we may have to look at, but I don't plan to spend a lot of time on it, and we'll get there. Meeting is adjourned. Thank you.